Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the February 14th, 2012 Morro Bay City Council meeting. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. Glad to see such a great crowd out tonight. Let the record reflect that all members of the City Council are present, and we'll begin, please, with a moment of silence. And if you would kindly stand and face the flag, we'll be led in the pledge by Los Osos Middle School 7th grader Maddie Fugel.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, for liberty and justice for all.
Announcements. Want to start with you tonight, Noah? Does that work?
Sure. I've got a number of announcements. Try to take them in order. Coming up this weekend, we have a very special presentation at the community garden up off of Ironwood on the way to Del Mar Park. It's a vermicomposting presentation, which means composting with worms. There's a number of local vermicomposters who will be there discussing how to set up a composting operation at your home, which is a lot of value for the community, and that reduces the burden of treatment at our wastewater treatment plant and gives you a great byproduct, which is good compost for your home and garden. And that workshop's going to be 1 to 3 at our Estero Bay Community Garden, the largest in the county, and it's $5 donation is requested. It's the Permaculture Institute, I believe, that's organized that. And again, that's this Sunday, the 19th, from 1 to 3. Our veteran support group is going to be happening again. The monthly meeting this month is on the 21st. It's a Tuesday at the Eagles Hall, 2988 Main Street. And that's Miss Deanna Kennedy that's organized those. There's a great resource for any veterans that you know that might want to tap into some of the many free resources that are available. And Deanna is committed to helping veterans get in touch with those resources. So again, that's Tuesday the 21st, and the meeting is from 6 to 8. It's a potluck. If you'd like more information.
Starts with the same letter. Good beginning. Morro Bay Beautiful will be holding their annual yard sale March 31st and April 1st. And as usual, that's the week before the major trash pickup, where whatever's left over you can put out. There is a charge to participate, but there are maps, and it's become quite a countywide event. You can get more information by checking with the Chamber of Commerce. February 24th, Friday, is spaghetti dinner at the Grange. It's $8 a person. You can pick it up and take it home, or stay there and visit while you have your spaghetti. That's all I have for the moment.
Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you. Just a reminder for anyone interested in Eco Rotary, the meetings are the second and fourth Thursday of the month at 5:30 at the Morro Bay Community Center. So the next meeting is the 23rd. And on Sunday, the 26th, the Bay Theater will be hosting a showing of a very special movie documentary on Bozzo Coricelli, Mr. Coricelli, who is one of our local treasures. So if anyone has an opportunity, that'll be a great event to get out to.
Thank you. And I wanted to thank two people and groups in the community. And one of those of you who go out and clean up our highways and our streets, and there's a couple of you who do it down in the Embarcadero, and you all do it quietly and don't ask for anything. But I want you people to know that you are noticed and you're appreciated. And I also wanted to say something to what the police call RPs, reporting parties, is that obviously, we are a safe community because of our police department, but our police department could not do their job if you didn't call, and you do. And I don't think it's being nosy. I think it's being aware. And when you see something amiss, you pick up the phone and you call our police department, who responds quickly. So thank you to all of you RPs, as the cops call you. Without you, we would not have the safe community that we do. And that said, Mr. Schultz, closed session report, please.
Yes, good evening. Prior to tonight's regular session, council met in closed session to discuss two different items. The first item was conference with labor negotiator. The second item was real property transactions, where the council discussed 3300 Panorama Drive and 895 Monterey Street. As to both these actions items, no action was taken that requires reporting under the Brown Act.
Thank you. Excellent job. I have several people I'm going to ask to come up first. If you'd indulge us, I would be grateful. So we are at the public comment period, and if any member of the public would like to address council, this is the appropriate time. And I'm going to invite Chad and Amy Oliveira of our business spot to come up first and introduce, tell us about the Waterfront Grill. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. Oliveira. Welcome.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, council members. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak tonight. My name is Amy Oliveira. I, along with my husband Chad, are the owners and operators of the Morro Bay Waterfront Grill, located at 571 Embarcadero in the Salt Building. We've been open since October, and so far I feel that we have developed a local following with locals and tourists alike. We're open 5 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. However, once daylight saving times comes, we're going to be open 7 days a week. On a personal note, I would just like to add that being in the restaurant business has given us the opportunity to meet many different people, and I'm very touched by the response that we have got from the locals. Everybody has been very supportive, very friendly, and very helpful, and I appreciate being made welcome into the community. Thank you.
Do you want to say anything, Chad? Oh, great.
I just wanted to add, obviously you can tell my wife's a little nervous speaking in front of everybody, but that by far has been the greatest thing for us so far, is it's the community, the support that we've gotten from everybody that lives here that comes in. We've got to meet some very special people that makes everything that restaurant owners, and I'm sure Mr. Lee will attest to, go through, especially with the difficult economy and so forth. So once again, I just like to say thank you for that, and hopefully you guys will come down and take in breakfast, lunch, or dinner, and see what we have to offer. Thank you, guys.
Great. We wish you all the luck in the world. That's the Waterfront Grill and the Salt Building on the Embarcadero. And Halley?
Representing all walks of life, the board will be responsible for creating 8 hours a day of local community programming. I am here tonight seeking, number one, your blessing. Number two, to create dialogue between the emergency communications, the police department, the fire department, so that we can have emergency communications on this frequency when necessary. And I'm also looking for interested parties that want to be a part of this board of directors of this exciting project. Thank you for your time tonight.
Thanks for coming down tonight and introducing yourself and your station, and we wish you all the luck in the world. And, you know, it's a small town. The fire chief, police chief, these are easy guys to pick up the phone and call. Keith Taylor.
Good evening, Mayor, Council, staff, friends at home. My name is Keith Taylor. I'm a resident of Morro Bay. I'd like to wish everyone a happy Valentine's Day. I'm here as the president of the Friends of the Morro Bay Fire Department, and we give scholarship awards each year. And how we do this is by the sale of the bricks and stones that are in front of the fire department. And right now we're doing phase two, so there's a chance for everyone, again, to purchase bricks or stones in front of the fire department. And this money goes to the Stuart Reed Memorial Foundation of the Friends of the Morro Bay Fire Department. And with this, the board of directors get solicited for grant scholarships to our firefighters. And it's mainly for Fire Academy and also paramedics. Tonight, I'm here to award a scholarship to David Gaycad of our fire department in the amount of $500. And if David could come up, I could give him the money. You want to say anything? Thank you, Mayor.
You're welcome, Keith. Congratulations, David. Good going. Who would like to go next? Mr. Riddell. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the City Council. I'm proud to serve on the Board of Directors for the Friends of the Morro Bay Fire Department. And we have two new members on the board, John and Meredith Finnessy, right back here. And I'd like to just, this is our order form for the bricks. You can pick it up at my office. You can pick it up from Keith Taylor. Where's his phone number? It's supposed to be on the display here.
Here
so
we
anyway,
come.
I'd like to just read you the beginning of this order form. The Friends of the Morro Bay Fire Department are raising money brick by brick so that firefighters can become paramedics. In our community, the emergency services provided by paramedics are vital to you, your family, and your neighbors. There are few scholarships available for paramedic training. The training is both time-consuming and expensive. A community-assisted scholarship will provide much-needed help to our firefighters and will enhance local safety services. And just for the people that don't know, these bricks can have your name on it, a family member's name on it. They can be in memorial too. They're going to go in front of the new fire department on the sidewalk. They're going to cost $125 for a brick, $550 for a large brick, and then if you want a special emblem on it, you'll have to talk to Keith about what that price is going to be.
AGP, can you put Keith's number? It's on the board. Get a shot of that, please. Go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. And we've sold 127, and we have 150 left to sell, and probably room for more than that. So we would really like to support these scholarships and have the community support us by buying these bricks. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much. We do applaud when we're honoring somebody like the fireman, but other than that, we don't applaud everybody who steps up. Who would like to come next? Don't be shy. Here we go, Gary.
Period about cigarette smoking. Is this the time to talk about it?
This would be a good time.
Okay, here we go. My opinion, this is my opinion only, and nobody else has talked to me to give permission or presentation of this cigarette smoking. In Morro Bay, I'm a past smoker of 40 years. I've lost several of my very good friends, including a very close friend of mine, my mother, due to cigarette smoking. So I'm here tonight to give you my opinion about cigarette smoking on the streets in Morro Bay. But before I do that, I want to give you a few facts about smoking. Cigarette butts are rainwater flowing into the streets in the first rain of the year. I was amazed by the hundreds of cigarette boats flowing into the estuary. Morro Bay, beautiful that I'm part of, we cannot believe the amount of cigarette butts that we find in the gutters and sidewalks on the Embarcadero and uptown. Years ago, Morro Bay Beautiful tried putting buckets in front of stores. Stores owners did not bother to clean out the buckets, and they were so messy we canceled the program. The days that I walk either on the Embarcadero or uptown, I generally have someone in front of me smoking, and it's going into my breathing tubes. This is a problem. Something needs to be done, but what? I don't want to make a law not to smoke. It was tried about alcohol and it didn't work, but we need to protect non-smokers somehow. People said if you eliminated cigarette smoking in grocery stores, bars, and et cetera, they'd lose businesses. Well, what do you think? What would happen if we had a smoke-free town like San Luis Obispo? But who's going to enforce it? Our police department does not have the men or women power to enforce it. Store owners are afraid to say too much for losing businesses. I think we should possibly have a workshop to discuss the problem in an adult manner before we make any decisions. I think we need to think outside the box. And I know it's an issue. The other day when I was walking... Oh, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Who would like to go next? Hi.
Hi, my name is Rachel Borbe. Happy Valentine's Day. I am the Friday Night Live coordinator for both Morro Bay High School and Los Osos Middle School, and I'm also the Estero Bay Youth Coalition chair, and we have some youth that would like to follow up on what Gary had to say. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Isaac Stanton. I'm in third grade at Del Mar Elementary. I think we should ban smoking in parks and on the sidewalks. The reasons are because people leave cigarette butts on the ground. The smoking causes lung cancer and other cancers, and smoking can kill you. I feel sick in the head and stomach when I'm around someone who's smoking. Smoke smells disgusting and also makes my nose hurt. Fresh air is good and doesn't hurt anybody. Please pass the ordinance to ban smoking in Morro Bay City parks, beaches, and sidewalks.
Hi, I'm Ariel, and I'm in sixth grade at Del Mar School. Smoking is hazardous because it can cause asthma and lung cancer. We should ban smoking in the city and parks because the smoke travels and it's bad for the environment. People leave cigarette butts everywhere we walk, and we have to clean it up. At the park, you'll find cigarette butts, lighters, or matches where we play on the slides or next to swings. Fire is dangerous, and if a little kid lights a match, it can cause something to burn. My main concerns are smoking is bad for the environment, bad for our health, and people might die. Please support the ban on smoking in the parks and city sidewalks.
Thank you, Ariel. Hi.
Hi, my name is Paula. I'm in third grade at Del Mar School. I think we should not smoke on the streets or in the parks because you can die from smoking and smoking can give you a bad heart. Cigarette smoke smells bad. The smell gets in your hair and clothes. The smoke pollutes the air. Let's fight for our community to be healthy. Please pass the ban on smoking in the city parks and sidewalks.
Thank you, Paula. Bye.
Hi, my name is Haley Revley, and I'm in fifth grade at Del Mar School. I enjoy taking walks and hanging out at the park. I have asthma, so it is hard to enjoy the time I have at the park when I have to be cautious about smoke. My great-grandmother died from smoking. To think about her dying is so scary, and to see people smoking where I hang out is disastrous. When I inhale your smoke, I get frightened that I might die also. Please support the ban on smoking in the city parks and city sidewalks and beaches. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Amy. Who would like to go next? Hi.
Hi. Good evening. My name is Haley Ramos, and I'm representing the Friday Night Live at Morro Bay High School, and I'm also the ASB president at Morro Bay.
I'm Gabby Nahara, and I'm from FNL, and I'm a senior. Go to play, and we shouldn't have to worry about smoke getting in their lungs or them finding cigarette butts where they can put in their mouths and possibly poison themselves.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for coming tonight. Step right up, ladies. Hi.
Hi. Hello. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. My name's Holly. I'm a junior at Morro Bay High School, and I'm also here representing Friday Night Live. When I think parks, I think families and children and playgrounds, and I realize that smoking is a private decision for an individual, but what a lot of smokers don't think about is the effects that their smoking has on those around them, especially children. When I was 6 years old, my brother turned 18 and started smoking freely in our house. I developed asthma and spent a lot of my 6 year in the hospital, and I was on uncomfortable machines with bad medication that made me dizzy, and I don't wish that upon any child.
Hi, I'm Angela Gerlich. I'm a senior at Morro Bay High School, and I'm also with FNL. The reason why I would love it for you guys to ban smoking is because when I was a baby, my mom smoked in my stomach, and I have mental problems and everything, and when I see someone smoking in an area with children, I just want to take the cigarette out of their mouth and throw it on the ground because it's so bad for them. They can get asthma and everything else and have horrible heart problems, and it's just not right. And you guys should really ban it, please.
Thank you, Angela. Thank you for coming tonight. I beat you to it. Hi.
Okay. Hi, my name is Rachel Erickson. I'm at Los Osos Middle School representing ASB and AVID.
Hi, I'm Maddie Fugel, and I'm in 7th grade at Los Osos Middle School. I'm representing Estero Bay Youth Coalition and Friday Night Live.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Revely. I'm in 8th grade at Los Osos Middle School, and I'm representing ABYC.
I personally think that we should have smoking banned in parks and sidewalks because my older sister, she's my half-sister, her father passed away from smoking and alcohol use, and it was really hard for her. My mom and her dad got a divorce when she was about 4 years old, and she had developed asthma, just really hard stuff for her to deal with because of his smoking. And smoking in the parks, actually, I have a few personal friends who have actually been asked if they wanted a cigarette. And people smoke, and it's just really bad for your health. So,
like Maddie, I also have a couple of my friends that smoke. And a lot of them go to the parks, which are right next to the schools, as we were saying earlier. So if it was more inconvenient for them, I don't think they'd be doing it like as much as they do, and it might cut off their supply of doing it. I know a lot of, well, not a lot, but quite a few of like my friends' relatives or family members and some of mine have died from smoking. So like seeing my friends and people around me smoking and that I know them and I love them and care for them, seeing them do that is really, it touches me in a horrible way because I don't want to see them die. But thank you.
I have asthma and it's really hard for me to play like with my little brothers and sisters at the park when people are smoking. I have to use my inhaler all the time because of the smoke. And it's not only bad for us humans, but it's also bad for animals because when people throw them on the ground, they just go around and eat them. And it's like, it's hard because it kills a lot of animals because they could choke on it or it can get in like their stomach and they can get really sick. But it's really hard for people to just walk around all the time and be around people that smoke because a lot of people have asthma. It's not just, like, a few people, but a lot of people get sick from the secondhand smoking. And it's just, we would like it to stop at the parks where the kids enjoy to play.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming down tonight. Hi.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and Council. I'm Dr. Steve Hansen. I'm the Medical Association member for the County Tobacco Control Coalition. Tobacco control has been a big part of my life. My dad was a tobacco company representative. I worked for one sales to minor law here. I want you to endorse Prop 29. You have my tobacco-related CV there and my private phone number. We can help you with any of this policy. We can help you get speakers for this issue. And You want to keep it simple. Tobacco-free is the way to go. It's easily understood. It's working there. The University of California just announced all campuses are going to be tobacco-free. That gets rid of the e-cigarettes and everything else. All of Oklahoma state government, for heaven's sakes, just announced that they're going entirely tobacco-free. Our county health commission, our parks and rec commission at the county, and all of the parks and rec commissioners, all dozen of them in San Luis Obispo, voted for tobacco-free because that's where it's at. That helps people really get the burden of nicotine addiction off their back. And I thank you so much for taking this up. It's only at the local level where we can really affect policy change. In the Congress of the United States, it only takes one senator to filibuster sensible regulation down. People in polls now would vote to ban tobacco, really. And so if you really want to help your population, you really want to help people quit, you really want to enhance the allure of your community as a nice, healthy place, go for tobacco-free. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Steve, for coming down tonight. Hi.
Hi. Good evening, Mayor, members of the City Council. I'm here representing the Tobacco Control Program in San Luis Obispo, located in the County Public Health Department.
Can you tell us your name, please?
Oh, Melissa. Sorry. I would first like to thank Morro Bay for even contemplating drafting an ordinance. That's a major step towards tobacco control. I would also like to commend the comprehensive staff report that was written on the ordinance. It was very thorough and excellent. One important area of tobacco control that hasn't been mentioned today is tobacco retail licensing. Over 90% of adult smokers today started before they were the age of 18, which is an alarming statistic. Tobacco retail licenses are a way to ensure that compliance checks used to monitor the sale of tobacco to minors are funded and ran on a consistent basis. These licenses require all tobacco retailers within the city to obtain a license through the city to sell tobacco products. An annual fee is collected and used to pay for the costs associated with administering the license, the licensing fees, and also the compliance monitoring done by the police departments. The ordinance also sets up a series of penalties for the incurred by the store owners as well as the store clerks if their establishment is caught selling tobacco to minors. Compliance checks are used to enforce the license and are run with the help of local police departments and teens like the ones you saw today. The last compliance check conducted in Morro Bay was in August 2010. Three out of 16, or 19% of Morro Bay retailers sold to our teen volunteer. That gives you a 16% sales rate. The average sales rate to minors in the state is 5.5%. Obviously, Morro Bay has a long way to go to reduce that rate. Tobacco retail licenses would be an efficient way to reduce Morro Bay's sales rate and ensure that retailers are being regulated. Cities that have adopted tobacco retail licenses in San Luis Obispo include San Luis Obispo City, Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, and also the unincorporated county. Those cities that have adopted and consistently enforced their licenses have seen a dramatic decrease in sales rates. Since San Luis Obispo City adopted their tobacco retail license, they've dropped their sales rate to the lowest in the county at 2.2%, only one of the 43 sold to our teen decoy. These licenses can be used to help Morro Bay reduce their sales rate and keep tobacco products out of the hands of minors. The Tobacco Control Program is a viable resource for any city who would like to pursue tobacco retail licensing. Staff can provide retailer education pre- and post-policy, recruitment of teen volunteers for compliance checks, and assistance during the drafting of the license. If Morro Bay chooses to move forward with drafting a smoking restriction, the Tobacco Control Program would like to assist in any way they feel necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. Hi.
Hi. Kathleen Carley. I'm a longtime resident. My kids went to Los Osos Junior High and Morro Bay High School. I'm the manager in the Public Health Department, division manager, and one of the programs I manage is the Tobacco Control Program. First of all, great job on the staff report. You address several things in there. You talk about a comprehensive ordinance. You talk about outdoor smoking, and I think our youth did an eloquent job talking about the reasons why you would want to ban smoking in your recreational areas. Melissa talked to you about tobacco retail licensing and the importance of that in keeping tobacco out of the hands of minors. The other issue you addressed, our program is here to support you. I've heard some people say that they'd like to have a workshop. We can help you. We can hook you up with resources at the state level that can help you in drafting a comprehensive ordinance, and we can supply some staff support. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thanks, Kathleen. Who'd like to go next? Step right up.
You want me to go? Okay. Good evening, Mayor Yates, council members. Susan Meharry and myself, we're here again tonight. We're on the Memorial Committee for the Central Coast Women for Fisheries. And we want to thank you.
And you're going to tell us your name, too.
Oh, Marlise Battistella.
There you are.
Okay. And thank you so much for your approval of our sculpture project and inviting us back tonight to show you the maquettes. And we're here to show you this, that we received them, and they're solid bronze, and they're of the Fisherman's Family Memorial. And those little people right there will be out out on the rock by Target Rock. Okay, now we're totally in the fundraising mode. We need to raise $54,000 more to complete this project. One of our fundraisers are the bronze maquettes. They will be on sale. We have we ordered 7 sets. We've already sold 4. We have 2 more for sale, and we will be doing a raffle for the 3rd set. But we can order more sets, but we have to order 50 sets. So we figured that if we could get 17 confirmed orders with a $100 deposit, that we can order 50 sets. They're selling for $739 plus tax. The finished size of our sculpture would be approximately 5 to 6 foot for the woman, and the children are all in proportion size. Please visit our website. It's womenforfish.org. All that you need to know about the sculpture. And following the sculpture, the full size from the foundry, we'll be putting everything up on our website. As you know, Elizabeth McQueen is the sculptor. And we have business cards on the table with our website. And we just thank you so much for your support. We're really looking forward to this community project.
Thank you, Marlise and Susan. Like we said last time, we love it. We love it. And we're here to support you and make this happen. We think it's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your efforts on this. Who would like to go next? Hi, Jamie.
Hello. Good evening, Council and Mayor. My name is Jamie Irons. I'm a resident of Moore Bay. I'm here to announce our 3rd annual Black Mountain Trail Work Day. And it's on Sunday, March 11th at 8 a.m.
If you could speak right into the microphone.
Okay, got it. It's at 8 a.m., and we meet at La Loma in Las Tunas. This is done in conjunction with State Parks and the Central Coast Concerned Mountain Bikers. At 8 o'clock, we'd meet. We've had our first one. We had about 30 volunteers. It's a really great event. We get people together. We do the trail maintenance. We do the brushing. There's, you know, that the trails themselves are used largely by neighborhoods. And so we're just asking for people to come out and volunteer and help support the trail system that we have. Just bring sturdy shoes, long sleeve shirts, and the willingness to get out and get a little dirty. So I hope to see everybody show up. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie. Betty?
Evening. My name is Betty Winholtz, and I'm here to actually address a couple of items on your consent agenda. The first one is the minutes from January 24th, 2012. my public comment in that section. All but the last sentence, I believe, is what I did reflects my intent of my comment. However, that last sentence does say, quote, as a whole, our elected officials are not being consistent. And in truth, the intent was not as a whole. I specifically called out Councilmember Borchard, and so I would like for that phrase, as a whole, to be replaced with Councilmember Borchard. In terms of A3, which is about the splitting of the Harbor Hut and or the Great American Fish Company's ask a request to split up their development. I don't really see an issue with that, but what I 30 years at Beverly Harvey. She was an active member of our community, particularly with the docents at the Museum of Natural History, also with the American Association of University Women. She grew up in the L.A. area. She was a tremendous activist down there, both in terms of city politics and in terms of the school board, and she died this last week. And I just want to honor her. She had a wonderful memorial service this past weekend, and the three things that they noted about her were that Beverly, as steward of the earth, because that was her real focus. She loved trees. She loved the earth. Beverly, as agent for social change, again, how she worked in the school system and with her city councils and has helped here in our community as well. And then Beverly as God seeker, that she was a testament to her two churches. And so I just want to honor her. Thank you.
Thank you, Betty. Who would like to go next? Hiya, Joe. Welcome.
Happy Valentine's Day. I want to call your attention to Agenda A2, the staff report. And it's just a recommendation I have. When you put these staff reports out in the future, if you could include the salary.
Sorry, Joe.
Yeah.
Would you identify yourself?
What's that?
State your name.
Oh, I didn't?
No,
I'm sorry. Joe Yukich, taxpayer in Morro Bay.
Thank you.
Do I start again, or am I running? Now, in the staff report, I'd just like to see mentioning salaries and benefits and what the end pension is on this. I don't think it's a lot to ask. When you put in things in here like fiscal impact, at the end of it, it says there will be no additional. Well, there is a fiscal impact, and that's putting another position in. So I'd like to see, you know, today I asked someone within the city how I could find this information, and I went fishing on your website. It's very hard to understand for the layman. So I'd just like to see this, the salaries, all of these issues inside of these reports from now on. My opinion on these things are that in these non-essential, non-public safety positions, sometimes we might be better served if we contract these out to the private sector. Naturally, you know, there might be some short-term small benefit, but in the end, in the long term, you know, we're stuck with these overburdened pensions that we're now suffering from. So that's something to always look at. And for my dollar, if it's not a police officer, a firefighter, somebody educating my kid, well, it's not that essential to me. So that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see a little bit more transparency and get these salaries, benefit packages, and end pensions into these staff reports. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for coming down tonight. Who would like to go next? Anybody else? Hi, Mr. Ross. Welcome.
My name is Jim Ross, resident of Morro Bay, and I'm here right now just to tell you that I've been picking up litter for 14 years with Morro Bay Beautiful, and this demonstration here is what I picked up at the off-ramp, on the southbound off-ramp at the circle, traffic circle coming into Morro Bay, in about an hour. And when I pick up litter, it takes about a third of the effort to pick up cigarette butts that it does to pick up everything else. And besides that, there seems to be less smoking today than there was 14 years ago, and that's something to look forward to. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that, Jim. Anyone else? Anybody? Going once? Going twice? That's how I pull the last one in. Hi.
Sorry. Laura Kelleher, good evening. I just want to support the possible beautifying Morro Bay. down at the Rock and up past Yerba Buena on the ocean. I think that's probably Chevron property, but I could just envision some of that drought-tolerant grass and some picnic tables and a parking lot and making it really nice. And some palm trees. And also palm trees down at the Rock on both sides. And also possibly that same grass and picnic tables and barbecues there as well. So it's just a little kind of low-looking with just gray and rocks and, you know, it's not very pretty. So also there's a need for restrooms here, there, and different areas of the coast. Maybe Toro Lane could use a restroom. And actually, Toro Lane could also, the end of it, maybe up on top, make it a public, it's a very large piece of property. Make it a very large parking lot with something else nice. Also, there's a need for a public walkover at 41 and Little Morro Creek Road.
And to speak to us. And to Laura, who's still with us, we are working on a project at the Rock, and if you want to write or email any one of us, I'll offer myself because I've got it. We'd be happy to share with you the plans that we're working on for down at the Rock. As far as up at the Chevron property, that's outside of the city limits, and our sphere of influence ends right there at the end of town. We're always open to ideas on how to beautify the town, though, and we're grateful. Palm trees is a new idea. That's very cool. Anybody want to comment on anything? Anything over here? We'll take a break, and we'll come back to the sorry. I'm always screwing up. Consent calendar. Anyone want to pull any?
Pull.
Over here?
A3 has to be pulled.
I understand that. Rob?
I'll pull A1 and A2.
All right, A1. Noah?
A1, I just wanted to follow up on Ms. Winholt's request to amend her comments. I think that's a courtesy if a member of the public would like their comments in the minutes to be adjusted. I think that's modest enough, and her recommendation is to change at the end the last sentence there as a whole to Councilmember Borchardt. I just want to respect her request.
If that's what she said, I'm fine with that. She said here it's about intent. How did you?
It's what I understood it to say. I can obviously go back and re-listen to it.
I mean, respectfully, Betty, if you're still here, there you are. If what I heard you say was, it wasn't your intent, and what the record has to reflect is what was said. So I'm going to suggest that the minutes go back, you focus on that sentence, and bring it back next time with her words. That work for you?
Okay.
Okay. A2, no action on A1 then?
No action. A2, just wanted to follow up there on the comments in the public comment regarding salaries and benefits. I'd like to give Mr. Woods a chance to discuss those, confirm that this position would be hired at the second tier for benefits, and give a little more detail to the public.
Certainly. Thank you. Councilman Smuckler, a little more volume. I have it on, but it's not quite working.
AGP, there's nothing. We need more volume on Joe's mic.
There we go. How's that? A little bit better. Thank you. Good evening, Councilman Smuckler and Council. A2 is our request for a position, a maintenance worker 2. The benefits, we haven't put those on here. They basically are two-tier. 2% at 60, I believe, is the pension plan that we've offered at your direction. The salary is within the maintenance worker 2 salary. It would be start off at step 1, and there's a series of 4 additional steps depending on merit and an individual's employment here. The benefits are a standard benefit full-time package that it depends on the individual, and there's a cafeteria-style benefit, but the individual may pay more if they've got a larger family that's going on the plan. So it's basically step 1, the maintenance worker 2, which is what we have on the books now, so you're not incurring any additional cost as far as the general fund allocation, and basically reducing your personnel costs by replacing them at a second-tier position.
And to confirm, this is a refilling of an existing position, not a new position being created?
Certainly. We've had a vacancy in this position. It's not basically a vacancy, but we've had this person out of the position since September. We've struggled quite a bit with the lack of this position in our rotation and our shifts. We've missed several essential meeting setups because of this, and we feel that in the course of all the years that we've been setting up in the last 4 or 5, we've been spot on, and this last few months have been tough for our maintenance crew, and that we feel that refilling this position will be certainly beneficial to them and the community as a whole.
Okay, thank you. And we'd like to give Ms. Luker a chance to discuss the accessibility of the salaries and benefit schedule for the different positions in the city as far as its accessibility on the website.
Currently, it's under employee compensation, which is on the left-hand side of the screen. It's an item you click on, and then they're listed. Perhaps the confusion is it's listed under SEIU, so we certainly can try to make that clear. I know that I sent an email to Mr. Jukic this afternoon concerning where to find that. The one thing I will add is that this individual will be paying 100% of the employee's portion of the PERS as a new employee, as well as the other changes that we've made.
Thank you, and I think there was a good point in those comments regarding if we can, as we bring future hires in on a staff report, if there was some information about that salary and those levels of the information you just gave us, Mr. Woods, or in other.
Okay, here we go on B1, the appeal on the 3390 Main Street. I have spoken with both of the appellants and Mr. Medina, and I think we all have the ground rules kind of set up. We're going to hear from staff, get a presentation from them. Then we will hear from Mr. Ross and Michelle. Oh, boy, Michelle, I told you I wouldn't blow your name. From Michelle. And and then we'll hear from Mr. Medina. Mr. Ross and Michelle will each have 5 minutes. Mr. Medina will have 10, so it's 10 and 10. And then we'll hear from the public, and then we will deliberate up here. So that's how this is going to run, and I will turn it over to Mr. Livick.
Yes, this is item B2, appeal of the amendment to the subdivision S089 and CPO 276 regarding placement of the driveway. And I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Sierra Davis, who will present the staff report.
Good evening, Mayor and Council members. The project before us tonight is an appeal of an amendment to a previously approved subdivision and coastal development permit for a two-parcel subdivision map and the construction of a two-story single-family residence. The applicant has requested an amendment to modify the required 50-foot buffer from the ESH, which is the environmentally sensitive area. The applicant requests further modification of the 50-foot ESH buffer to allow for a second driveway. The driveway is approximately 133 feet long, and that would lead to the it's on parcel 2, and it leads to the house on parcel 2. A little background on the project. The Planning Commission approved the project originally on July 19, 2010. That was the original approvals. And the project was approved. However, the request to reduce the buffer to less than 50 feet was denied. Subsequent to that approval, the applicant worked with his engineer and determined that it would be hazardous to locate the driveway outside the 25-foot buffer, as the 25-foot buffer is approximately 11 feet from the existing house on parcel 1, and it would also go across parcel 1. The amendment to that the applicant applied for an amendment after determining it was hazardous to place the driveway out of the 25-foot buffer. The amendment was heard at the January 4th, 2012 meeting at Planning Commission, and during the meeting, staff presented all of the previous information on the project, and the staff report detailed the project proposal, analysis of the local coastal plan and municipal code policies, and the environmental assessment, which was circulated with the original proposal. After hearing the item, Planning Commission took action to conditionally approve the project as recommended by staff, so the amendment was approved, and two appeals were filed during the appeal time frame from Michelle Erte and James A. Ross. Many of the issues are have been brought up by the appellants previously in other for the other items, and their issues are detailed on page 4 of the staff report. The main issue remains the reduction in the buffer as from the previously approved 50-foot buffer. Pursuant to the municipal code, the applicant has consulted with the California State Department of Fish and Game and the Coastal Commission to reduce the buffer, which they can do. If they request to reduce the buffer further, they do have to consult with those two agencies. The applicant has consulted with those two agencies, and there are letters from those two agencies as seen in attachment 3 and 4 of the staff report, and so they've adhered to those conditions, and staff has also included conditions with the requirements of Department of Fish and Game and the California Coastal Commission in the staff report. The local coastal plan and municipal codes were also addressed in the January 4th, 2012 Planning Commission packet, as seen in Attachment 2, and the city attorney has prepared additional analysis of the local coastal plan in his memorandum, also attached to this. At the public hearing, the Planning Commission determined that the amendment is in substantial conformance with the environmental document
requirements.
At that point in the driveway, fire department access is not required. It's just the driveway was constrained so much, and it would be in a curved situation. Getting even a conventional vehicle around that corner did not appear to be practicable.
So from the fire department's perspective, though, they could make that turn as proposed by the Planning Commission at that point?
Fire department access at that point was not required. So there,
but they was required deeper into the driveway.
No, fire department access is not required, with the exception of the first 20 feet. And the chief is looking at the viability even that requiring the first 20 feet to be fire accessible, because why go into the property only 20 feet when there's a public street right there?
Okay, so from the fire department's perspective, the 2010 Planning Commission decision would not cause a problem from a fire prevention and fighting standpoint.
It meets the code requirements of that. I'm not going to speak for the chief and say that.
But yeah, it meets the
requirements. Yes.
Okay, thank you. My other question has to do with, and I'm not sure how to what degree this is part of our discussion tonight. You know, we're talking about mostly this driveway, but the concept of drainage. I've met with a couple of the neighbors and understand the history there and the impacts from the previous project as far as drainage to their area. How would we address the drainage going forward for this proposed extension of the project, and then also going backwards, do you feel like that those drainage issues have been resolved?
The project as approved in 2010 carried on the requirement to provide that positive drainage across the front of the property, and in their preliminary plans for their subdivision, they have shown a swale across the front of the property that would drain basically the property that's on the corner of Vachon and Main Street. By my inspection of the site, it appears that there is positive drainage out there, but they're going to make those improvements. This is a project condition. The condition would not be, need to be satisfied until they're looking to record their final map, and there's a they're a ways away from that point in the process. They're still kind of in the middle of this process. They've only asked to amend their project. They're not at the point to final their project. So that condition would need to be satisfied prior to the finaling of the final map.
Okay, and in regards to that second parcel, then at that point, new conditions could be introduced to address any potential drainage issues created by that second phase, the second parcel.
No new conditions can be added. The state of California has one bite of the apple rule that conditions that could have been imposed at the time of subdivision map, you can't create new conditions. There are code requirements on the books that they need to provide for, you know, positive drainage across that lot. So we'll be looking when they develop that lot towards their final grading plan to make sure they've accommodated drainage.
Okay. Those are my questions for now. Thank you.
Okay, let's ask Ms. Arete to come up first.
Good evening. Hi. I'm Michelle Arete, owner of 361 Vachon Street, and I'm representing 200 petition and letter signers. I am not opposed to responsible development of property. I have actually been involved in land development in Mammoth Lakes and Dana Point, and I do support development that is appropriate for the area. On my appeal, page 11, B, C, and D, the findings of the CDP all relate to another project with modulars, so this must be an error and does not justify this CDP. On page 12, Exhibit B, 4, and 7, it is not in compliance with the local coastal plan policy, and I will explain. Policy 11.14, the parcel has been deemed usable by the Planning Commission. On July 19th of 2010, therefore, according to this policy, the applicant does not qualify for a reduction to the buffer. In addition, where riparian vegetation has been previously removed, the buffer shall allow for the reestablishment of vegetation, increase the size of the house to 2,497 square feet, as stated in the postcard we received dated 12/21/11, and increase the size and length of the driveway. We're not saying don't build, but we are asking that building in this area be in accordance with the laws and policies and also in accordance with the July 19, 2010 permit that would be upheld, as they did deem the parcel usable. So they figured it out, and that would be the 1,800 square foot house in the 1,300 square foot driveway and 25 feet from the buffer, and that was equitable, fair, and deemed the parcel usable. You have received emails from Chris Delleth, senior biologist of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, who stated that red-leg frogs were sighted in No Name Creek. It is documented, and if these frogs are observed anywhere along the creek, then it's highly likely they exist in numerous places along that creek. The protocol for site assessment for endangered species is 23 pages long. Now, that's important because it is a two-day and two-night study. It's not just a walkthrough visual that the applicants have his hired biologist perform. So we do ask that it would be fair and that USFW perform this two-day assessment. The letters and observations from Fish and Game, biologists, and Coastal Commission are outdated and do not apply to the current encroachment of the creek bank now that the applicant is amending the permit. He must go back to the five agencies that are involved in the decisions and get current reports. And these five agencies are Army Corps of Engineers. They have not been consulted, and they are the first ones that should have been consulted. U.S. Fish and Wildlife, now that we have documentation on the endangered species found here. Water Quality Control Board, have they been consulted? Fish and Game regarding willow, and now a stream bed alteration agreement is now needed if there's encroachment on the creek. California Coastal Commission, again, a current report now that encroachment on Creek Bank is proposed. CEQA must also be in compliance, as now there is encroachment on the creek. These agencies must be aware of the new modifications and give an opportunity to review current encroachment and determine if there are non-compliant violations of state and federal laws. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Arite. Mr. Ross?
My name is James A. Ross. I live at 311 Trinidad Street, Morro Bay. And I thank the planning department for giving me the bundle of information that they had on it. I read through it, and from what I could understand, I had some questions. So I went back to the planning commission, and they did an excellent job of explaining their position in approving this project. I am not against the project, but I am definitely against going so close to the edge. And if they're going to go further into the 25-foot zone than they have to, I don't think it's necessary. My feeling is that if they have a 10-foot drive around to the new property, why can't, if they have an emergency vehicle to get within 150 feet, can't they go into the drive of 3390? It's large enough and there's access, and therefore they could get by with a 10-foot access to the rear property. I am also asking, and it's been pretty well addressed already in your discussions, about the drainage to the new parcel, the lot 2, and apparently the city will make sure that that happens should they build the property out. Mr. Medina, when he built his property almost 10 years ago, I guess, never addressed the drainage until now when he has to do it. So it would behoove the city, when they do build, to make darn sure that they were getting drainage through the second property. And I'm also asking that the city make sure that they don't approve on many different projects, the city, the planning commission, or whatever, so many exceptions to our codes and ordinances. I feel that by doing so, they're taking away from the quality of life of the people that live here. And if they're going to do that, they should change the codes and ordinances and get them approved so they don't have to make so many exceptions when they do this. Thank you very much.
It's approval, but we couldn't get one to fit because there's just no way to access it, whether you come off the current driveway or put a new driveway completely in. So our current adjustment to the plan is only to allow access to the driveway, and everything else is within the boundaries. We're not trying to get a whole bunch of reductions in the 25-foot buffer or anything farther than is required just for access. So that's all we're asking for, and hopefully we can keep our approval from the last meeting and move forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, start with you, Carl. For me? Oh, public comment. It is public comment, and I'm always forgetting. So if any of you would like to address us on this, please step right up. Hi.
My name is William Dalek. I live at 3351 Whidbey Way in Morro Bay. I've lived there for 33 years, and the changes that I've seen in the creek area were very marked right prior to the July meeting of last year, which upset me and a lot of the neighbors. We've seen the creek area very adversely impacted. Things were cut down, cut back. I mean, it was pretty much mowed over. This impacts the quality of life in our area. I mean, the creek area was a wonderful area, and it's been very, like I said, adversely impacted. If you could see photos of it prior to the way it is now. It's just really upsetting. And I went to the meeting July 2010, and it was my understanding that there was access and that there was access that was going to be allowed and the buffers were not going to be impacted. And then suddenly, you know, in January, I find out that in fact the Planning Commission is going to allow a reduction of those buffers. And I spoke at that July meeting, as I and a lot of others were very much upset about the impact on the creek. And it was my understanding also that the creek was going to be allowed, that the creek area was going to be restored, and I haven't seen much restoration there. I haven't heard any dire situations here or any dangerous situations. I mean, it appears that the fire department doesn't have a problem with what was approved in July, and that was fine with me. I want him to have access, but I don't want to see any more impact to the creek, and I don't want to see those buffers reduced. And I don't think that that should be necessary. And I really urge the council to go along with what was approved at the July meeting of 2010. And that's agreeable to, I mean, I think I and the neighbors that I've talked to agree that that was fine. It's fair to everyone. But they're proposing to reduce that buffer, and I do not believe that that should be done. Thank you.
Thank you for coming down tonight. Who'd like to go next?
Good evening, Council and Mayor. I'll make sure I'm close to the mic this time. My name is Jamie Irons, resident of Moore Bay, and I'm also a former planning commission for this project on two times, in 2010 and 2011. So, first of all, to speak to the 2010 Planning Commission discussion and decision on that, I think it's worth noting that it wasn't appealed at that time. Planning Commission at that time, I think, worked diligently through the project with the constraints that were there. And we should note that the constraints are largely a result of the applicant themselves. They designed the first house there. That just the layout of the house, the first house that's there, really instilled the constraints that they have, that they're working with right now. If they had worked with a project that had two houses at the time of the original project, that would have been a consideration at the creek through the whole project. So I think to consider that at the 2010 meeting, like I say, I think we were thoughtful and we worked through that project. And in the staff report, basically it says that this is a perceived hazard and that it's not doable. I believe that it is doable, even to the extent that if... can I borrow your pointer for a minute? Where's the guy here? Is this it? How's this work? Give me a second here. Second one? Help me out, Joe.
Here he comes. Here comes your,
all right, thanks.
Your technician.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi, my name is Laura Mounts, owner of 330 Vachon Street. As you see in the area photos of the creek in the 1990s, before the applicant built their first house, there were groves of willows on both sides of the creek bank. In the photos of 2009, it shows willows growing back in the southeast creek bank. 1 year later, in 2010, they are shorter. And also, Councilman Nancy Johnson walked the site in 2009 of July and observed the barren land and the absence of the willows in the creek bank. We have, in 2009 packet, a signed affidavit for people who witnessed landscapers grading the creek bank and the land destroying the willows. This was the major concern to the Planning Commission on July 20th of 2009. Please see the minutes detailing the lengthy discussion of the willows chopped down and destroyed. The staff report of 2009 states, quote, "It should be noted that the willows do come back even when cut. Therefore, it would appear that The cutting of the willows would have to occur continually, or the roots of the willows will be removed in their entirety in order to have the reduction in the vegetation we see today. In addition, staff would like to say that the original house built on the site was conditioned to perform restoration work within the ESHA area, and therefore, if the conditions were to have been done by the applicant today, we would see a more healthy ESHA area, and not one where the riparian vegetation has been reduced, unquote. The applicant's biologist he hired, Mike McGovern, also notes in his memos that the photos taller than vegetation existed in the earlier half of the property in question. Today in 2012, there can be seen the southwest east creek bank, a short grove of willows about 8 inches tall. This is where the applicant wants to pave over and put a driveway. This is also where he's conditioned to restore the vegetation. Now he wants to further destroy it. Legally, he must stay 50 feet from those willows. This is perhaps why the willows have not been allowed to grow here naturally. We ask the five agencies to come out and make current reports regarding the two-day site assessment that is done by USFW regarding the red-legged frog that has been sighted in this creek. The red-legged frog sightings are documented in the California Natural Diversity Database, also called CNDDB. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening again. My name is Betty Winholtz. My comments regarding this project are specifically to address the attorney, city attorney's memorandum. My initial concern is that the attorney is telling the council how to vote. I'm saying this because he states that this memorandum is offered to, quote, support the denial. As a public employee, he has spent public money through the use of his time writing an extensive eight-page defense with numerous quotes and sightings of a private person's project. Not just an analysis, but telling you how to vote. My second point is that the memo contends that this hearing is only about the buffer. It is not. The appeals include concerns about previously unfulfilled conditions and maintenance of the conservation easement. These are conditions that the applicant wants to be relieved of as part of the amendment. Third, I agree that the LCP policy 11.14 is the crux of the major, not only, issue. The memo wants you to question the status of the ESHA as not ESHA. You cannot for these reasons. One, the ESHA designation is recorded on all city maps as confirmed by the city attorney in his memo. Two, when given the option to, quote, remove the ESHA designation, instead, Coastal Commission staff, quote, concurs with the ESHA delineation prepared by the applicant's consultants. So this does not go along with what his contention was. Three, due to the presence of the willows, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, quote, recommends that a wetland determination be made by the Corps of Engineers. And there's no documentation in your staff report that this has been done. Fourth, the real question here is the buffer and its legal, what is legally permissible here. City law, the local coastal plan, clearly states, quote, but in no case shall the buffer be reduced to less than 25 feet for urban areas. The word shall is not a negotiable word. The city attorney's memo would have you believe that government agencies and experts say it is okay to invade this 25-foot setback. However, they do not. If you read their actual comments, each refers to a 50-foot setback. None acknowledge nor agree to violating the 25-foot absolute minimum. The California Department of Fish and Game even tags the end of their correspondence with the quote, please be aware you're responsible with compliance for all applicable local, state, and federal.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. My name is John Barta. About 50 years ago, just 50 years ago, in fact, the United States was behind the Russians in a race to space. They had put up Sputnik. They'd put Yuri Gagarin into orbit around the Earth, and we were behind, and we didn't know what we were going to do. And just 50 years ago, we orbited John Glenn around the Earth as a great American space achievement, still behind the Russians. And while we were behind the Russians, our young president that we all love so much, He had faith that America was a can-do nation, and so he challenged the Russians to go to the moon, take a man to the moon, and return him safely to the Earth within a decade. And following that, with his faith and with what America would do, we did send a man to the moon, and we did return him safely to the Earth. America is a can-do nation. That's what we're proud of, okay? Turn to this project here. 307 pages of staff report are before you. These folks want a little piece of the American dream. And so they've gone through all this regulatory stuff. They've heard from biologist after biologist. Some even say this is not really an ESHA. And in fact, if you look at it and go in the area around there, you will see that for two blocks prior to this zone, which you see in the pictures, this so-called creek is nothing but a drain that's underneath a whole condo project. It goes for two blocks. And then it pops out into this little area, and then right out of this area it goes into another drain that goes under the freeway, okay? It's hardly an ESHA. But on that issue, okay, the biologists have spoken. There is no damage here, okay? What I just found out in looking at the map with the city attorney is that he's not asking for anything beyond the existing wall. There's a wall there right now, okay? There's a wall that was put in there, you know, years ago when it was originally approved for the first house. He's not asking for anything beyond that. I think there's some confusion about that. And there is a simple solution if necessary, okay? And that solution is that he asked for an easement for whatever amount of land is necessary, and I think there may be none. But if there's any, it might be a tiny little corner there, and stay within that wall, and you know everybody should go home happy. Unfortunately, I think that somehow, you know, we've lost our way as a nation. I think that, you know, we've turned from a can-do nation into a can't-do nation. What I hear tonight is a lot of people looking for an excuse for you guys to say no, okay? My urge to you is to do what it takes to help this family, this man, do his project, and let's be a little bit smart. Let's do what we have to do. My suggestion is, if necessary, require him to get an easement for whatever minimal amount is necessary, if at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Anyone else? Anybody? You know, Mr. Medina, you've had your bite at the apple, and you know, unless somebody asks you a question, we're going to have to close it down. So I'm sorry about that. Okay, back to you, Carla.
I'm just going to start with a question then for staff that Mr. Barta just raised about granting an easement to themselves through the property so that we wouldn't even have to be doing any of this, and I'm not sure why that wouldn't have been an option.
As Mr. Barter related, that they're asking for to maintain their driveway, on the side of the existing wall. Well, that still encroaches into a portion of the 25-foot ESH buffer with or without a easement there. That existing wall and development is a portion of the buffer. So granting the easement doesn't completely obliterate the need for an encroachment into that ESH buffer. Now, could perhaps minimize that encroachment down to just the point where it goes around the house, but it really does not eliminate that need.
But it reduces it.
Yes, it does.
Significantly. Okay. That's all. I'm going to wait till I'll wait till the rest of council.
Okay, I have a few questions here that have come up. Let's see where to start. Now, my understanding, having been through this before a couple of years ago, is that these conditions of approval that our planning commission, I'll call it that because I was there, put on this are still open, that they don't have to be completed until what point he gets his permit for the house or he finishes the second house. At what point does he need to complete his conditions of approval?
There's a variety of conditions, and some of them have different trigger points. But I think for the ones that we're concerned about here, it's the recording of the subdivision map that would be the trigger point, for example, for them that was a condition from the previous development. That one would need to be satisfied prior to map recordation. The we've heard some question of whether the second house would be blocking drainage from the existing neighborhood. That would need to be shown on their grading plan for the second house building permit, showing that they're allowing that drainage to pass through the property.
Now, it was my understanding that at one point all these homes, which I think are on Vashon, drained into that property. Is that until he built his first house? Is that the natural drainage?
The natural drainage appears to be at least the back part of the property is at front on Vashon, drained back towards the creek there. With the development of the first house, there's been some suggestion that that blocked some drainage, although my review of the actual field conditions, there appears to be a swale that around the front of that 3390 main property that would take that drainage around the corner.
Okay. All right. The question of these willows, I know I remember going out and looking at them. Were they cut down at some point?
I couldn't tell you. I didn't observe the willows there, whether they were there in the first place. I know that the city does creek maintenance. In the past, the city used to go onto private property and cut willows that were in creek channels. We have a permit from Fish and Game that allows us to use hand tools to cut willows. The thinking is you really can never get rid of a willow. It kind of comes back with a vengeance when you cut it back. So we were allowed to go in there and cut willows. In 2006, I believe the council directed city crews to stop going onto private property and cutting willows unless we are granted permission from those property owners. I also know that property owners receive letters on an annual basis from the fire department directing them to cut vegetation down. I cannot speak directly to which willows were cut nor when.
Okay, thank you. That makes it clear as mud. All right, now back to the small version of the plot map that you had up there a minute ago. I just want to be really clear where they want to put this driveway, because you just said they're not asking to go beyond the wall. Could you clarify that for us? You had the one up there a minute ago.
I'll do it by both of them. There's currently a retaining wall that goes here and here. You can see it right there on the map. Their proposal is to not encroach any further into that, and that's been their project since 2009. There will be no encroachment. That retaining wall will remain right where it is right now, so there's no further. And all of the other agencies, when they reviewed the project in 2009, agreed that no further encroachment into the Esha area, the project could be approved. Their proposal that went in front of Planning Commission did have a little jagged. So you've got the existing retaining wall right here that's currently existing. Their proposal was to move that out a little bit, but the Planning Commission, just in the last time around in 2011, said that they could not do that and they could not further encroach. So there won't be any further encroachment than is already there with the retaining wall that currently exists.
Okay, this is maybe going to sound like a really silly question, but if they're not encroaching, they're not going beyond this wall that they have, what's the problem?
The Esh buffer extends beyond the wall.
But they already are at the wall.
Yes, but by definition, the Esh buffer is 25 or 50 feet away from the Esh boundary.
Okay.
When they mapped the Esh boundary, and then you offset that line to that 25-foot buffer line, it encroaches. There's a coincidence of between the driveway and that ash buffer.
And how...
Or that retaining wall, I'm sorry.
How wide is that? And for how long?
Here is the current... Where'd it go? Well, here is the current retaining wall right here.
Right.
Here is the 25-foot buffer. Here is the corner of the home. Here's the property line. So the actual 25-foot buffer is right where the property line, if you were not able to. But this whole area is already with on this side of the retaining wall. There's not going to be any movement of the current retaining wall.
But there is that one spot on the other side, that little bump up there. Towards
up there, but yeah. The Planning Commission did not allow for that. So he has to remain and cannot do any further retaining into the current, outside this current wall. So this line, when the final plans come in, will show that it'll match where the current retaining wall is.
And how close to that corner of the house will that go?
From the current retaining wall to the corner of the home is 21, is it?
Approximately.
So it certainly is possible when staff looked at it. I mean, one of our main issues when staff looked at it was this, you have four agencies all stating after their review of the project that so long as there's not further encroachment past this retaining wall, the project would not create any significant impact to the ESHA. We took that into consideration. And then we took into consideration, well, you certainly could make it smaller in this area and require an easement and relook at this. But is retaining wall still going to stay in the same spot? So you're not doing any benefit to the ESHA because the retaining wall already exists.
Okay. One last question, then I'm going to move on. If, in fact, we do permit this driveway there, can we require him to have a permeable surface so that the water will drain through?
I believe the applicant has proposed a permeable surface for most of the driveway, and I think we condition the project for a permeable surface for the remaining portion of the driveway on the when they granted the exception. Sierra's going to help me.
Okay,
and,
thank you. There was so much paper in this, and it got a little confusing after a while. Only 300 pages, right? It was my weekend reading.
The condition states the entire proposed driveway shall be constructed using low impact development techniques, specifically permeable pavers to provide filtration of stormwater prior to entering the stream corridor, is the existing condition on the project.
Thank you very much.
Well, Nancy covered it pretty well, everything that I was questioning. I walked over this property today, in fact, pretty thorough. And the only thing I was really kind of bothered about is how close that highway is coming into that bridge area there. I talked about that a little bit. And it looks like to me that I'm no engineer of how driveways should be developed, but it seems like that they could use a common driveway there and still get around that corner. It looks like it'd be kind of funny looking as they build a driveway and then a little bit of a walkway and then another driveway. It just it appeared to me a little bit odd there. But anyway, that's the only thing I looked at it and thought, because everything else, he seems to be doing the right things. But just the driveway, I just wondered if it possibly could be used as a common driveway there. It's plenty wide. So that's about the only question besides the ones that Nancy had already cleared.
I guess before I turn it over to Noah, I'll ask you to address, you were there, so you know what he's talking about.
Yes, that is a definite possibility. It's not the proposal presented by the applicant, and like we've talked about before,
the existing retaining wall. There's no proposed change to that existing retaining wall's location, so there didn't seem to be a purpose served by having the common driveway, and it's not what the applicant's desire is, to have two completely separate lots without an encroachment from one onto the other.
And we certainly looked at that from a staff level. I mean, it's what you're saying is, here's the common driveway, and the car to the back lot would come around here and come in here. And if you keep the same retaining wall, you certainly have saved this area from being paved right here. That's not an ESHA area or any benefit that we saw, and that's not what the applicant wanted, but that's certainly an option the council has. The issue still is if he uses the same common driveway, can he get around this corner without going into the 25-foot buffer area? And their engineer says it's not possible. And at less than, I think in some areas it's 11, but I even question whether it might be less than that. If you go back to the earlier one, right around that one area where the line is on, the 25-foot buffer is on the property line.
You good, George?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'm just kind of surprised that this has been declared an ESHA. I mean, like I said, it looks like a drainage ditch. But, okay.
Noah.
Yeah, thank you. I think I'll just follow up on Mr. League's comments and suggest that you can see that our planning commission, the existing planning commission, or the one that last visited this, was also sharing those concerns with you in their 3-2 vote. You see that two of the commissioners felt similar to you, and I agree with them that there is sufficient room with the existing driveway to fit this in and not sprawl further north and into that existing open space, and so that we can do this. I appreciated their ideas, and then of course going back from that planning commission to the 2010 planning commission, they also hashed that out, and I felt like those were thoughtful ideas that allow a development there. It's not a taking of his rights to build, and I'm going to stand by that decision because I think that's what will satisfy the neighborhood in talking with them, which is very important, and also respect the ESHA rules and boundaries. So, in my opinion, I think the 2010 Planning Commission decision should stand, and we should go with that.
I should have done this at the end of public hearing or public input, I mean, or maybe before, but I did want to acknowledge on behalf of council that we did receive emails from Eric and Chris Lilo, Michelle, two emails, Stuart and Haja Chrisman, and Abe Parisian. Hope I'm pronouncing those names correctly. I'm going to withhold. I'm good on questions. Should I go back to Carla? Let's just do it the same direction again.
No, I'm going to agree with the comments that have been made by my fellow council members at this point. I'm satisfied with the answers.
Nancy?
Oh, I just have one more question here. If, in fact, where would the property lines be when he you know, formally makes his two lots, and would this home still fit within the new home would, I'm sure, but would this one still, you know, would the sides still be large enough to meet our standards? The sides of the lot, you know, the. I'm sorry, I'm at a loss for words at the moment.
The minimum lot size in the zoning district is 6,000 square feet. And I'm going to look towards the applicant's engineer. That parcel number one, was that downsized to 6,000 square feet to...
Hmm?
Terry Orton, Orton Engineering. It's just slightly larger than 6,000 square feet.
So, thank you, Terry. These property lines are only on paper right now, since this is a tentative map. But they did downsize parcel number one, the one closest to Maine, so that they could move the house on parcel number two closer to Maine and remove it from the 50-foot ESH buffer. That was the direction from the 2010, July 2010 Planning Commission. So these property lines are kind of set at, so parcel number one has the zoning district minimum lot sizes in there. The only way to accomplish that driveway moving further to the southwest would be to encumber parcel one with an easement benefiting parcel number two.
And okay, so parcel number one, the house that's already constructed, would the setback still fit within our requirements?
Yes. Yes, they have to. They have to meet within the requirements. The easement would not affect the setbacks.
Okay. And would giving them an easement be detrimental in some way, shape, or form?
Encumbrance of a lot, some would consider detrimental. That's speculative on my part, whether it actually would devalue the lot. Maybe Mr. Schultz can add to that.
It would be speculative, but it certainly is within your prerogative if you want to do that and make it a requirement. I just had a question for Councilmember Smuckler. You mentioned about, and I was at the hearing, the Planning Commission in 11 with the 3-2 vote. And what I wasn't clear about your comments was is requiring the easement and requiring the applicant to use this same driveway as the other one, but still allowing when that second would come around and still be able to encroach into the 25-foot buffer over here? Or were you saying that the not only an easement but also staying out of this entire 25-foot buffer was the clarification I was wondering? Just
yep.
Limit the 25-foot buffer to the minimum possible with an easement or not to allow it at all was what I was looking for clarification.
My preference is not to allow it at all. I think that's in line with the 2010 Planning Commission decision, and I believe that we're having this discussion because of the design of the first lot and the first parcel, and that was obviously done by the same applicant. So we're wrestling with this massive mound of paper because of decisions that were made by the same party. So my opinion, it's not our burden to sort this out. We have to work within our rules to help them develop the second parcel, but they've created this situation. So I don't have any feelings towards us trying to create exceptions that will have further impacts to the neighborhood, will create additional precedents in that neighborhood for future projects. I think we need to remain true to that, considering the comments we've received and the amount of work that the 2010 Planning Commission put into their deliberations.
Back to you.
To make a motion.
Well, I think it's fine to, you know, blame the applicant. You know, the house exists. It's there. The ESH is getting encroached upon whichever way you go. Sorry about that. you know, respectfully, George, and Noah, to force somebody to use an existing driveway, I mean, their ultimate goal here is to divide these two and have two separate standalone properties with homes without an encumbrance, without a, help me, easement. It's staying on this side of the retaining wall. You know, I just don't have a, I think I'm going to be in the minority here. I just don't have a problem with this. with granting this. It doesn't. It just doesn't seem like that big a deal to me. But that's in the face of this. So that's real. So go ahead and make your motion, Carla.
I move that we uphold the appeal and direct the project to follow the 2010 Planning Commission approval.
Second.
Pardon me. Discussion.
And I would in discussion say, just in response to yours, that I don't feel that it I support property rights. I don't feel that them granting an easement to the other property is going to restrict anything in their opportunities or encumber their property in the future based on the laws for easements. So.
Discussion.
Well, I felt in my what I was talking about that the if there's any way they can use this driveway, I don't want to kill this project. Don't get me wrong here. You know, I don't think anybody does. It's just that I can't see why they can't use this common driveway. It doesn't make sense to me. I actually went out there earlier, and then I went back myself and took a look at this, and I just had to. I just think that this common driveway is a way to go out there. I just don't feel like I'd like to see another driveway out there, and especially it gets so close to that bridge that comes across there, and I'm thinking there'd be children and stuff coming across there and playing, and I don't know, but I don't see where this hinders this project one bit.
Anything else?
Yes. I think I'll stand by the decision that was made in 2010 to use a common driveway. I know, driving around Morro Bay, that there are lots of homes that are built with common driveways, especially up in North Morro Bay. It's not an uncommon thing to do. Easements are legalized and formalized. So there should be no question as to whose is what. So I will be voting in favor of the motion.
Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries 4-1. Congratulations to the appellants. B2. Ms. Wold isn't here. Ms. Delivick. Did I miss something?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This is review of a draft zoning text amendment to amend section 17.48.32 of the secondary units. In March of last year, city attorney brought forward this item to city council. City council directed staff to amend the zoning code to be in conformance with state law requiring only ministerial review to increase the supply of secondary dwelling units and affordable housing. Additionally, council wanted us to look at the second unit shall not exceed the maximum allowable 1,200 square feet for state guidelines. The architectural compatibility the language should be changed to reasonably compatible, only require one open and uncovered space, but not be tandem, and no requirement for a conditional use permit. This item went to the Planning Commission on December 7th, 2011. Planning Commission recommended that the language regarding architectural compatibility shall be consistent and or reasonably compatible
I just want to point out that consistent and reasonably compatible are synonymous terms. They kind of mean the same thing. That the increased floor area of an attached second unit shall not exceed 30% of the existing living area, and that's per state law, so we would need to make that code, and a detached unit shall not exceed 1,200 square feet. We're asking for council to review these changes, to make any further recommendations for the zoning text amendment change, and direct staff to bring back this as an ordinance change for first reading at the next council meeting. With that, that concludes my staff report.
And an excellent staff report it was.
And turn it back to City Council.
Noah?
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Levick, would you mind reviewing a bit of the history of how we came to the existing regulations as far as the 900 square feet?
The 900 square feet came to City Council in 2005. Was codified into the city municipal code, but was never certified by the California Coastal Commission. So while the city adopted that requirement, it was never brought forward to the Coastal Commission for their certification. We needed to look back to make these changes to the last certified code. That's why you see the strikeout in the text as the prior code. I've attached what we have in our municipal code as attachment two to what that language is. I don't have an answer to why that was never brought forward to Planning Commission. That was prior to me working for the city, so I'm not sure why it didn't, why it didn't move forward to Coastal Commission.
Thank you. Follow up on that, I guess I'd like to ask Mr. Schultz then about the public input and involvement component that got us to the existing municipal code.
The current one that hasn't been certified?
Yes.
Yeah, it went through the Planning Commission and went through the City Council. Well, I know it went to City Council. I'm trying to remember if we went through the Planning Commission. But then it was part of that 2005 package for our entire zoning update. So it was part of the package we did send to the Coastal Commission, except that what was supposedly going to happen is we were going to get a review of our LCP and get that through the process, and then they were going to pick up our complete zoning rewrite and look at that, and that was part of that LCP zoning of 2005. Neither one of those moved forward at Coastal Commission and are now stale, so that's why it was never certified. We did put it, though, in our code, and we began making any project that came forward subject to those changes that were made in 2005. When we now have brought up the new changes, we want to make certain that we go to Coastal Commission and get it certified. So we wrestled with the idea of, if we go with the amendment of our current code and we send that up to Coastal Commission, they're going to look at us and say, why are you making changes to something that we haven't seen yet? So we thought it would be best to go back to what was certified and make the changes from that. But I think the record reflects what really did happen, and when it goes to Coastal Commission, they'll see the fact that we did change it in 2005 and didn't apply that, and did apply those changes to the projects during that interim period.
Okay. To follow up, though, I'm very interested in the public participation component that brought us to the 2005 update. From what I understand, that included public hearings as well as a workshop.
For the entire zoning code, absolutely. I'm trying to remember, and I don't offhand, how many public hearings we had for the changes. I know at council, though, it went through extensive hearings, because I can remember in my mind Thad Baxley was on the council at that time, and I do remember there being hearings at council that were much more participated in from the public than what we're going through right now.
Yeah. And, of course, the council then in 2005 approved those, I'm assuming, with the intent for certification at some point.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. My other question is, have we done a review of, in other coastal communities in our county, have we done a review of what their regulations are for the square footage for a secondary unit?
No, this was, the 1,200 square feet was based on direction from previous council action. So our goal was not to question what we were directed to change the ordinance to.
So we lack data about what other communities are doing in the area as far as being able to look at that and weigh that into this decision tonight.
Correct. We did not perform any research to find out whether other cities are doing, but we did follow the direction of the council from March 22nd, 2011.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the 1,200 square feet is not to exceed by the state's requirements, but there are no stipulations that it cannot be more restrictive as many communities do decide to take as far as their pathway and decision-making.
That's correct.
And as we currently have.
Exactly, and that was what I wanted to bring up also, at least from my standpoint and staff's. Our thought process was when that ordinance was enacted in 2005, it was much more restrictive than the state requirements, and that our feeling was is we would go and enforce that, codify it, enforce it at a city level, even though the certified one at Coastal Commission was less restrictive. And that, in fact, if, in fact, someone was going to challenge that ordinance and appeal it to Coastal Commission, it would have been an applicant trying to take away a more restrictive ordinance at the Coastal Commission as opposed to the other way around, whereas if council is going to take a strict zoning ordinance that we have and try to undo it, I think we're better off trying to get the LCP passed before we make it less restrictive. So in that sense, yes, we were using that 2005 ordinance because it was more restrictive.
Okay. thank you. Those are my questions for now.
This is a public hearing. If any of you would like to address council on this item, this is the time. Step right up. Jamie?
I'm busy tonight. Jamie Irons, resident Moore Bay, and past planning commissioner through this decision as well. I'm going to cover a couple of things and questions that were asked tonight. Council, as I have written down here, through the staff report, tonight's staff report anyway, so council directed staff to prepare a report for the secondary unit regulation, but this is a direction from council initially. That's where it was initiated from. At that point, really, there's no data that from planning staff, from public, or anything else that would indicate that the ordinance itself had a problem. No public outcry, no concerns, no public comment from builders as well. Council directed staff to use the old ordinance, per the staff report anyway, as the base document to work from because the changes approved by council in 2005 were never certified by Coastal, as discussed in this staff report. Even Mr. Schultz discussed, you know, why it wasn't certified, but that's a serious question. Why wasn't it? Why wasn't it codified? Here's an ordinance that was passed by council by resolution. So, in other words, we should address that situation as well. Why wasn't it certified? And where did we miss that? The secondary units came about out of public concern for their neighborhoods. There was a three-day public workshop. In that public workshop, it resulted into that produced this current ordinance. There was workshops as well just for that secondary ordinance. You can see where I'm going here. There was public input on this ordinance. It was done through public process with public input with thoughtful considerations. The council majority is overturning that public process by a single notice for planning commission and council as if it were a text amendment, and it's not. But these actions of the council majority are consistent with your failure to listen and consider the entire community as a whole. This is merely an amendment for a special interest group. Tonight, you should reconsider your actions. The council majority is stripping the public process from the very public who took the time to participate in the vision of their community to write the current ordinance. Reconsider and do the right thing. Send this back to a public workshop and do it the right way instead of stripping it the way it is tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? John? Betty?
No, let John go first.
Well, I think you beat him. Betty, separate up, please.
Betty Winholtz, I would just concur with everything that Mr. Irons said. I was on the council at the time. This was a completely out of a public outcry for what was going on in our community, that small lots were being subdivided with two houses of the same size being built, one being declared a granny unit. They were both 1,200 square feet. Obviously, they're both then going to be subdivided and sold separately. It was a builder's dream, and the community was outraged. And the council listened. They had workshops and it worked well. And the fact that it never, having gone off council to find out that it never went through the Coastal Commission is, for me, a lay the fault at staff. Three things keep being repeated in the staff report, and that I want to correct. They keep saying that this is to fix our ordinance in terms of regarding compliance with the state law, and I appreciate that it's already been pointed out that we have been in compliance, and that the community saw that 900 square feet was really much more affordable than a 1,200 square feet, which is the second error that keeps being repeated in the staff report and by others who support it, that, quote, increasing small affordable housing units is the purpose of this ordinance. How can that be if you're going from 900 square feet up to 1,200? That just doesn't make sense. And then the third error that keeps occurring and that has been addressed already, while ensuring that units remain compatible with existing neighborhood. And that, of course, is false because you've completely loosened that and made it a may instead of a stronger requirement that you have to fit with your neighborhood. I was on the council at the time. I know that's what Mr. Iron said is true. This was from the public output. This came strictly out of you and the council. I think it was even Ms. Johnson that brought it forward back a year ago in January. And it's shocking to me that you would want to undermine the public process. And I would suggest that the Coastal Commission is not an excuse of why you need to go back to the old way. I don't think they care whether we have 1,200 or 900 square feet. It's what the community decides and that they will uphold that. And so I think that's a weak excuse for going back and not using them as your excuse for doing what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Betty.
Good evening once again, John Barta. So much misinformation, so little time to rebut it. The granny unit act has absolutely nothing to do with land being subdivided and sold separately, period. Never was, never will be, okay? Granny units are there because they allow us to have a healthy community. Nobody's required to build a 1,200 square foot granny unit. They can build less than that if they want to, but they can build up to 1,200 feet. Granny units cannot be built anywhere outside the envelope that somebody could put a whole house on. So there's nothing going outside of that, nothing somebody couldn't build a whole house on. What you see in your packet, what is referred to as the old one, did go through a public process. It was approved by the Coastal Commission back in the late 90s when I was on the commission. That's the one you're working from, okay? All of this hysterical talk about it, the fact is the proof is in the pudding, okay? From 2005 until the present, we've had this more restrictive one, in fact, so restrictive that barely any granny units have been built during this period. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. It's not happening. It was happening before. It's not happening now. Do we want to have a viable community where the people that live in the community can afford, that work in the community can afford to live in the community? Do we want to use existing infrastructure, or do we want to grow outside our boundaries? Those are the real questions here, and the answer is we need a robust granny unit program to do that. You guys directed it to be done. It went to the Planning Commission. They saw it through. And I got to tell you, one thing that just grates me is when somebody gets up here who made a motion at the Planning Commission and got their motion accepted to add the 30% language and the reasonably compatible stuff, and then turns around and votes against it after they get what they want in it, and then comes up here and asks you guys. It just blows my mind. Good luck.
Anyone else? Anybody? Okay, I'll bring it back to council. Start with you again, Noah.
Yeah, thank you. Well, what we currently have allows granny units, and I stand by the comments that were made that we really don't have any good data to make a decision like this tonight, particularly considering the economic conditions we've been in. I think that has more influence on whether or not people are building these units currently or not during those last number of years. And for us to go forward with this tonight, I agree with the public comment that we're abandoning a very strong, robust public participation process for really arbitrary reasons or unsupported reasons. We don't even have a review of what other communities in our county are doing. And I think that would, at a minimum, be important. And without exception, we should have another workshop if we're planning on changing what the last public involvement created. So for us to go around that is, I think, irresponsible. When it comes to affordable community, if you're looking for a place to rent and the majority of the homes or options for you are larger options, then that's obviously going to increase the cost of those rentals. And I resonated with some of the comments made by our last planning commission when they talked about that. There was a commissioner who actually said, if most of the granny units in our community or secondary units are at $12,000, that's just going to be more expensive for a renter as opposed to $900. And I think we need to recognize that. I think the $900 is a fair number. It's a good amount of space that will fit within the community, and we came to that decision again with community participation. So I'm very uncomfortable with how we proceed if this is the case. I would like to stick with the existing ordinance that was developed with public process and move forward for certification on that.
George?
Well, I think the owner of the property understands what size he's going to build there. I mean, just like it was brought up, you don't have to build a 1,200 square foot home. Yeah, if the property owner thinks that he needs to have a 900 foot square home to rent, well, that's what he's going to build. But I don't see anything wrong with taking it up to 1,200 square feet, as long as the property owner thinks he's going to be able to rent it out. You're talking about affordable housing. Well, I think these are still affordable homes. And there will be, not all of these homes will be 1,200 square foot. So I just don't understand what the big deal is. I think, you know, there's going to be a car parked in front of a 900 square foot or a 1,200 square foot, it's going to take up the same amount of room. And I think that was one of the complaints before, that where does these cars park? Anyway, I don't see any problem with going up with this.
Nor do I. I think, you know, waiting to compare ourselves to other communities is irrelevant. It's irrelevant what other communities are doing. They're either going up to 1,200 or they're less. You know, I don't think 1,200 square feet is too big, and as George just said and has been said, that the assumption that everybody is going to build a secondary unit to 1,199 square feet, I mean, that's just an assumption. We certainly don't know that. The idea of building a secondary unit and then selling it off, that's been addressed. That doesn't happen. That can't happen. You'd have to subdivide your lot. We don't subdivide our lots here. That's smoke and mirrors to me. And, you know, doing another workshop, I mean, we're going through a process now of come back. Would there be two more public hearings on this after this? Two more public hearings after this. So
one more.
One more. Okay. I'm good with this. Nancy?
I'm good with it, too. I agree with George. 1,200 square feet is still a reasonably sized smaller home. I don't think it's huge. This has been workshopped to death, I think. It's gone on for years. There was input the first time around, so you can't say we didn't listen to the public. The other planning commission, the other city council has listened to the public. We've had two public hearings so far, and it's the same people. I don't see a lot of new voices out there saying, change this. So I'm ready to stick with our original proposal with this issue.
Well, I agree. We're having a public process right now, and it's been ongoing since we brought this back in March of last year. That is public process. We're all available, public comment, public hearings, planning commission. The idea of going back to the 1,200 square foot allowable was to help the applicants expedite a project and save some of the cost of having to go to a CUP. So by not having to go to the Planning Commission, you can still build, you're right, regardless of whether you go get a permit or you don't, up to 1,200 square feet. So as all this is doing is removing that condition in between there of cost and time to the applicant. And I agree with all the rest of you. Not everybody's going to build a 1,200 square foot granny unit. It doesn't fit in the box. You can't build it. There's not, you have to meet the setbacks and everything. It self-regulates. And I think that it'll help us with our housing inventory, and certainly I'm sure that there are, as Mr. Barta alluded to, some people haven't built over the last few years because you can't make your money back as the property owner building a 900-square-foot house, which is limiting you to the revenue source or the potential use for family and other things. By going to 1,200 square foot, it'll allow you the opportunity to recoup some of that cost. The permit fees are set, so I'm good.
Can I invite a motion?
I will.
Say anything?
I'll make a motion.
Go ahead.
Move approval of B2 with changes.
I'll second.
With changes, is that
with the changes that are?
If we just approve B2,
yeah,
then we're good. Okay. And George seconded. Thank you very much. Any other comments over here, Noah?
Yeah. I would actually state that this is scuttling the public process, disrespecting the amount of people that were involved with those workshops, with creating our existing ordinance, and you're looking at this solely from the perspective of a landowner, and we all know how sensitive our neighborhoods are to building and construction. I think that previous ordinance was developed considering the property rights of that landowner and also of their neighbors. And what we're doing tonight is disregarding a very long and drawn-out public process, and I don't think that's the way we should be conducting business.
In your view, is that fair to say? Okay. Well, you were stating facts, and that's your view, and I can respect that. Anything else? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 4-1. Thank you. Let's take another break, and we'll come back. And thank you, Mr. Franco, for your patience. Three meaty ones. I don't know. Andrea, I did mean to talk to you that you're welcome to invite Mr. Franco up. And when you finish, I'm going to give it to you. D1, Ms. Luker.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. Tonight, I'm presenting a discussion on the closure of the Atascadero State Beach or Morro Strand. Since the announcement of the closure of Morro Strand in May of 2011, the city's been in communication with state parks to review and discuss the potentials for keeping this incredibly important asset to our community open. We have sent several communications to state parks regarding the status, including one in May that we sent also to the Senate Appropriations Committee's members in support of SB 356. SB 356 would have required the Department of State Parks to notify a city or a county that they intend to fully close a park within that county or city's jurisdiction and give that county or city the option of assuming the responsibility for the park. The city also sent a second correspondence in August of 2011 to the Director of State Parks, Ruth Coleman, as well as District Superintendent Mr. Franco, reiterating our support of SB 356, as well as our ongoing concerns with closure of the state park. In October of 2011, SB 356 was not signed by Governor Brown, as you might know. He felt it was duplicative, as there are currently numerous localities within the state of California that already have signed agreements to operate state parks. Interestingly, in the case of Morro Bay, the city currently has an operating agreement with state parks for the state park marina, as well as the city currently exercises regulatory authority over the California Tideland Trust lands. In terms of Morro Strand specifically, California State Parks has been working on various options for keeping that state park open, and they're currently, or they have been meeting with Cal Poly for some time in hopes to pursue a unique partnership which would allow the typical learn-by-doing operation with Cal Poly. They're talking about the possibility of cooperative efforts, including state parks and the biology department, the public sciences department, recreation parks and tourism departments, and the College of Research and Graduate Programs at Cal Poly to operate Morro Strand State Park, in addition to the Cal Poly Corporation involved as the nonprofit to assist with the mechanics of contracting and operation. In our discussion with state parks, their goal is to have a draft framework and a good understanding of the likelihood of this agreement by March. If there is not an agreement by March with Cal Poly, it appears that they will proceed with a request for proposals for concessionaires to operate the park. We are currently, State Parks is going to be holding several state park partnership workshops throughout the state. We'll be attending, I believe, the one in Los Angeles, which is in March of this year. And these workshops are designed to offer nonprofit organizations or public agencies information about assuming some or all of the functions of operating the state park. In conclusion, we agree with the recent articles that certainly have been in the newspaper that it's incredibly important to keep this state park open, and we're working along with state parks in order to make sure that happens. Those are my comments. I will, as the mayor said, Mr. Franco has, our district superintendent has agreed to spend a Valentine's Day with us this evening, and he's in the audience, and he certainly is here to answer any questions you might have about the specifics.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for coming tonight. Thank you for waiting.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and council members. No better Valentine's than this, right? I invited my wife to come with me, but she decided not to. The park closures, that's a result of a budget cut, obviously, to state parks. There's numerous budget cuts that have happened over the last 5 years. This most recent one is a $22 million reduction, and we were directed to do that reduction through park closures, and there was a specific set of criteria that were established in order to achieve those park closures. So 70 parks were listed throughout the state park system for park closures in this area. Morro Strand, obviously, is the one that we're here talking about. Clearly, I didn't start my career in my teens and been working forever, and neither has anybody else in the state park system in order to close parks. That's the last thing we want to do. So we're trying to come up with different ways of keeping parks open. Really, there's three basic options. Donor agreements, so that's where somebody comes in and just writes a check. Here's how much you need. Here's a check. You know, go forth. Concession agreements, that's where we put out a request for proposals, and a for-profit business comes in and operates a park or operates a portion of a park or something along those lines, and operating agreements, which we currently have the authority to do with government entities, but legislation did pass earlier in the year or last year. That allows us to enter into those operating agreements with nonprofits as well. So that was the only change that occurred within this time period of talking about park closures. Our direction is to implement park closures July 1st of this year. So we're getting down to that wire. What we're doing at Morrow Strand is really, as Andrea said, working with Cal Poly to try and get that moving. Hopefully we can get that worked out, and then everybody's happy, and we have a really good model for how to operate a park. If that doesn't work, then we'll look at the request for proposals. We're having difficulty right now because that requires approval of the legislature or the Public Works Board, and trying to get those through those processes has been a challenge for some other parks that we're trying to put out for a request for proposal. So that's not something within our department's control. That's something outside of our department's control, and we're working through that process. If we don't have something in place by March or April, at least that's looking solid, then we'll move forward with the process to close down the park. But that doesn't mean that that's the end of it. That doesn't mean we stop talking. So even if we got to park closures, we would still be working for somebody to come forward to reopen the park or to operate it in some manner. So that's kind of the status of where we are. These workshops are coming up, and that's to gain any sort of interest from whether it's a concessionaire or a donor or a nonprofit, anybody who's interested in operating any of these parks. So any questions you have, I'm more than happy to answer those.
Well, I guess a statement right up front that, like, July 1st is the worst time, probably the worst date you could pick to close that park. You know that.
Yeah, beginning of the fiscal year.
It's right in the middle of when it's packed. We have a local operator who's expressed an interest in running it. I mean, so we have at least one competent professional that's ready, willing, and able. We know you're working with Cal Poly. But like I told you at the break, I mean, our goal is to keep it open. We want those visitors. We want the visitors. If your Cal Poly deal falls through in, as you say, March or April, do we still have time to make something happen?
Sure. Just because March or April is a kind of a turning point where we really have to start for the closure process, that doesn't mean that people can't talk to me now. So if somebody has an express interest in operating the park, give me a call, send me an email, get in touch with me, or anybody comes to you saying, hey, I would like to operate this, please direct them to me, and I can start talking with them now. I mean, just because I'm talking with Cal Poly doesn't mean I won't talk with anybody else. I'll talk with anybody who's interested in keeping the park open.
And what about these, as you alluded to, cumbersome RFP process? I know if we had it, we couldn't just hand it to this particular person I'm talking about. We have to put it, go through a process, and get the best deal we can.
Correct.
What's your... How would that work with you?
We would still go through that same process. That doesn't mean if a private company is interested in operating it, it would have to go through the RFP process. But I'm still willing to talk to them now, because that certainly helps the argument when we go to whether it's Public Works Board or the legislature to say, hey, I've had discussions with five different people who are interested, all of whom seem to have the capacity to actually operate it. That's a stronger argument for them to approve an RFP, because they know there are people out there who are going to bid on it.
Well, I'll call him in the morning. I think I just have a sense you know who I'm talking about, and
sure.
I just don't want to say his name publicly. Before I call him, though, he's going to know that what's happened here.
Sure.
And, so he'll be calling you.
Okay.
Noah?
Sure. Thank you. I'm just curious to know, with the discussions with Cal Poly, is that at the moment the highest priority option in your mind, or would that be folded into a general RFP process?
No, that would be negotiated. That's an operating agreement, because it would be an operating agreement with a nonprofit, with Cal Poly Corporation. Right now, that's the most promising, because that seems to be most in line with our mission. It still is providing education. It's providing a good opportunity for the public to get here and to enjoy the facility. It certainly provides a good training for a future workforce from the recreation, parks, and tourism departments, from the biology departments, the political science departments. So there's a lot of overlap of mission and purpose. So that's why that's a pretty desirable partnership. But like I said, that's not the only one that's out there. That's just the one that has been moving along the most.
Great. I would agree. I think it's a very intriguing option, and I wonder if there's anything that you think the city could do to help support that dialogue, to see if it can we can help you make an agreement. Is there something that you think would be
probably not at this point, but there might be in the future, depending on the details of Cal Poly Corporation's concerns of operation or any questions that they have as it relates to the city.
Okay. And then I noticed here in the staff report there's this State Park Partnerships Workshop that is coming up either February or early March, and it looks like it's designed to offer nonprofit organizations, public agencies, information on assuming some or all the functions of the state park. Would you recommend that we have, because it's obviously a priority for us, that we have a member representing that the city at those workshops?
They're nice to go to, certainly. It's going to provide a lot of information. What I would suggest is go to our website first, so the state parks website, which is parks.ca.gov. And in there, there's a link to the workshops and the partnership workbook. So that kind of gives you an overview of what the workshops are going to be. The way they're going to be structured is the first half will go through that workbook, which kind of defines what we're looking for in a proposal. And then the second half is actual interaction with the whoever the district superintendent is for the park that you're interested in. So obviously we're having that interaction. So you know that part of it probably not going to be as valuable to you. But the workbook part certainly could give you an indication of how interested you might be at attending.
Okay, great, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't have any direct questions for him, but I know, to repeat after the mayor, I'm sure we're going to do all we can to keep this park open one way or another. So, and I think we all feel the same way.
Thank you.
No questions. Well, I do have a question. Of course, this is of the utmost importance to all of us, especially with July 1st as the closing date. That's really scary. You mentioned a moment ago that people could get hold of you. Would you be willing to give a phone number or email address out? A lot of people watch these broadcasts.
Sure. Yeah. My phone number is area code 805-927-2065. And the email address is nfranco, that's N-F-R-A-N-C-O, at hearstcastle.com.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Yes, thank you for being so patient tonight. I do have some questions. And just for, I think, clarification, Mr. Smuckler's request, staff is intending on going to those workshops. Is that correct?
Yes, we're planning on going to the Los Angeles workshop, which is March 1st.
Thank you. Depending on private concessionaire, I guess, so my understanding originally was it had to go through a municipality. But based on what you're saying now, if Cal Poly wasn't the interested concessionaire, you would work directly with those RFPs so the city does not have to be directly involved in it then? Is that...
Well, like I said, there's three options. So one is a donor agreement.
Right.
And the donor agreement is just somebody who wants to donate cash to cover the cost of the operation. Another option is a concession agreement, and that's where we go through the RFP process and engage a private company to operate the park. The third option is an operating agreement, and the operating agreement covers cities or nonprofits or counties or JPAs or any of a whole host of other sort of government agencies or nonprofit agencies. So that can just be negotiated. So if the city said, hey, we'd love to spend a lot of our city cash on operating and managing Plovers and things like that, then yeah, we could have that discussion and we could do that right now. So that's something that we certainly could do. And that's just negotiated. That's not part of the RFP.
So that brings me to my next question. The plover monitoring specific to that park area, how does that play into if a nonprofit is not going to do it and a for-profit, because that's still going to be required by parks or fish and game or whoever.
Right.
And that seems to be, looking at the information you gave us in the past, one of the largest expenses of maintaining that park.
Correct.
Is that separated out from what would be expected of a concessionaire, or are they going to bear that?
They would have to bear that in some manner. That's one of the reasons that Cal Poly is a good fit, because they already have those fish and wildlife permits in their biology department. Most of our environmental scientists came out of Cal Poly learning from those professors on how to do just this sort of thing. So that's why that's a good fit, that permit's already there and that they know how to do that. Anybody else coming in, that's going to be a learning curve, and that's going to be difficult. Whether they do that, whether they use some revenues or some other funding to reimburse our costs and then we continue to do that, or whether they have their own specialists that do that, there's a whole suite of options that they could do. But if you're providing for the recreation out there, then you have to address the birds out there. So that's just going to be a requirement.
So nobody comes forward and the park closes, you still have to monitor the park?
Well, that's where it gets interesting, is if the park's closed, then that's actually cheaper, because now you can just fence off the entire area, and the monitoring is actually less because it's closed. It's all illegal activity. So it's a kind of a squishy part of the law, but that's where we would still have cost. I mean, it's not going to be free. It's not going to be $0 for the state. We're still going to have cost. It's probably going to be less than what we do now, because we won't have to create the corridors from the campground. We won't have to do all of those activities that we do now to allow access through the plover areas. We just fence off the whole plover area.
Who enforces it, being the doomsdayer here, who enforces the closures?
We do. So there's a cost associated with that. Absolutely. Yes.
I just see where this would be very cost prohibitive for a private vendor to come in and try and do this with that plover monitoring as part of it. I think that's the biggest obstacle.
I agree with you.
This is kind of news to me, too, because I'd heard different. I guess I'd heard that you'd keep doing the plover monitoring and somebody could take it over. That's it could be if you can't operate it at a profit. Not that a private operator is not more efficient because it's
sure.
not governmental.
Yeah.
It's still a big deal. It's a big deal.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, if we weren't doing plover monitoring at all, we probably would be making a profit at that park. I mean, that's where our profit margin falls down.
Did you want something else?
Well, I just don't understand then why, I mean, I guess this is just stupid, why it's not separated out if one is a government regulation, and I don't understand how that factors in to the operating costs. Like you said, it would be a profitable thing. So
sure.
So basically, really, the only option at this point is Cal Poly, and if Cal Poly isn't doing it, we're looking at
It's not. I mean,
certainly,
a private operator, if a private operator is able to come in and generate enough revenue, whether that's through fees or whatever business model they have, and generate enough income to cover the cost that we expend for the plover monitoring, they could contract with us to provide that plover monitoring. So that saves us our expenses, which is obviously the goal of the budget cut, is to save expenses. So that's one way that they could do that. So it's not a complete obstacle, but it certainly is a hurdle to get over.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question you just brought up. What is the cost of plover monitoring for there?
And that's a hard figure to come up with to the dollar, because it changes year to year, and we distribute those costs over our entire district, not just specific to there. But on average, it's about $30,000 a year that we spend on plovers, and another $50,000 or so that we spend on the habitat associated with the plovers. So $80,000 a year for the plover and the habitat associated with it.
Only at
Morro
the Strand.
Oh, yeah.
$80,000 a year.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. And that goes on no matter what?
No, it changes. So it goes on as long as activity is allowed at the park.
Right, okay.
If that activity changes, so no camping, for instance, then the cost would go down. How much, I don't know, because we haven't done that.
So you'd still have to monitor them at least to a degree.
Right. We'd still have to do something. What level of something, I'm not sure yet.
Thank you.
You would still be enforcement, for instance, right?
We'd still have enforcement, but that's not the bulk of our cost, obviously. The bulk of our cost is just is going out there daily and counting the birds and monitoring the birds and fixing the fence and putting up the fence and taking down the fence and putting up exclosures and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it would be kind of a bummer to have it fenced off all year round.
Yeah, it would.
I mean, that would not be good for the community.
That wouldn't be good for anybody.
No one.
Yeah, I think that's an understatement.
Within
those costs, I've got the sheet that you've provided to us that has the breakdown of all the different costs of operations and also the revenues. And with that $50,000 for the dune restoration and ice plant removal, is that also a requirement? Or could that fade outside of the plover monitoring being maintained?
It could be reduced. You can't completely eliminate it. If you completely eliminate it now, you're degrading the habitat. So essentially, you're allowing that encroachment to come back. And if you do, now you're decreasing the nesting habitat, and you got more problems because now you're going to have less birds. You have less birds now with your permit to manage the birds. You're showing a decline in the population, so clearly you're not managing properly and those sorts of things. So in our annual reports that we would submit, we would certainly show that we weren't doing a very good job.
And just for the public's information, based on this estimate that you provided to us, our total revenue annually is about $237,000 a year. Total cost is $259,000, so a rough difference of about $22,000 a year as far as that's in the black.
Correct.
One of my questions would be, you may have answered this, I was reading just a bit, if there was a private contractor that came in, could they contract with you for the continued monitoring, just to confirm that?
Yes.
Okay, great. Another question I have to our staff, is it clear who our staff point person is for this project or this this priority?
At this point, it's been me. I believe Mr. Woods and I may be going down together to Los Angeles for the seminar.
Okay, so as far as that question about supporting this Cal Poly proposal, you feel comfortable that the lines of communication are there and phones can be picked up?
We talk a lot.
Good to hear.
Anything else? I guess, you know, we're not going to take any action on this, obviously. It's an informational item for us. We're really, really grateful for you sitting there for 3 hours. if there's any more questions from anybody before we let him go, get to his wife on Valentine's Day.
All right.
I mean, you know how we feel, and you know our concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'll, short of murder, we'll do just about anything to keep that open.
Yeah.
So... I'm sensing that Andrea has volunteered to be the official point person on this. So, keep and I know you talk a lot, and keep the communication open and try not to let the other deals, get to be April 30th before we find out it's not going to work and then we're down to 60 days because it's going to be very difficult. But we'll do whatever it takes to help make this work. All right, thank you so much for coming tonight, Nick. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
D2, Rob.
Yes, good evening again, Mayor and Council. D2 is a discussion and consideration of regulating public smoking. This item is in front of you based on Council's direction. I've provided you with a staff report, and you heard quite a bit of public comment during the public comment period. So I'll be brief. I'm basically looking for direction on whether you do want to enact a ordinance that would regulate secondhand smoking. We currently do not allow smoking on our beaches and on our tea piers, but the issue is whether you should extend that or whether you would like to extend that to other areas. I've broken my staff report into different areas that I'd like you to provide input on. And that is many cities have provide for protections from indoor or enclosed working spaces, which goes beyond our current law, and I provide that on page 2 of 7 the different areas where residents, different cities have extended protections in enclosed areas to more than is currently available through state and federal law. Then I'd like you also to talk about protections for outdoor public areas, and I list those as not only the parks, which we currently do not regulate from a city standpoint, but from a state standpoint, you're not allowed to smoke within 25 feet of the playground equipment. But I list on page 3, 1 through 7, where you can extend that to such places as dining areas, entryways, public events, recreation areas, which we just talked about, parks, service areas, sidewalks, and work sites. So that's the second area I need input from you. The third area, and this was also discussed during your public comment, is regulating secondhand smoke in housing, which is on private property, and whether you want to extend that also to those areas, which is in the common areas, or even in the individual units, which is on page 4 of my staff report. And then on 5, to even go further, if you'd like me to bring back an ordinance that would regulate tobacco sales, which was talked about a little bit by Dr. Hansen, and the tobacco retail licensing is discussed on page 6. So if you'd like, I'd go into further of those categories, but I think you've got a feel on the different areas and where you want to extend this ordinance, or whether you want to extend it at all, is the issue in front of you.
Nancy, your item.
Thank you. All right, ready to go here. Just as an introduction, I don't know how many people know, but the whole country of Ireland is now smoke-free. I remember the last time I was in Ireland, we'd drive around looking for a restaurant that we could walk into, and that's completely changed now. Several years ago, as you've heard, it became illegal to smoke on our beaches. This issue arose again a few months ago when a young man who works at Taco Bell came to our public comment and asked if there wasn't something we could do to keep people from blowing smoke in his face while he served them at the drive-up window. He's far from the only one in Morro Bay who's complained about secondhand smoke, as you saw tonight. We know and we've heard about the dangers of smoking and the health effects from secondhand smoke. I think it's time that we in Morro Bay take the step that a lot of other cities in California have already taken and make it illegal to smoke on our streets and at drive-up window restaurants, among other things. I've talked with merchants, and they feel that the restrictions on smoking would not be detrimental to their businesses. I also called the San Luis Obispo Downtown Merchants Association and asked them about the effects of the smoking ban on their business, and they responded that it had not been a problem. Not only are the discarded cigarette butts ugly, as Mr. Ross showed you earlier, they're also a danger to our bay. As was mentioned earlier, the butts flow into the bay and the estuary. They don't decompose. They linger, and they're a hazard for wildlife. Another minor hazard is trying to tend the planter boxes around town. You'll find that many people use those as places to get rid of their cigarette butts, which isn't good for the flowers or the people digging in the flower planters. And so for these reasons, I think we really need to move forward with this. As long as it's my turn, I'll tell you what I want, and then you guys can decide what you'll let us have. I particularly liked Mr. Schultz's listing approach on page 3 of 7. And if you look at the areas, starting with number 1, dining areas, and I'm not going to read them all to you. If you get down to number 5, service areas defined as bus stops, ticket lines, ATM lines, taxi stands, etc., I would at that point like to add drive-up windows. That would be banks and restaurants also. Sidewalks and streets, number 6. I really am not sure about number 7. I have a son who works in the construction industry, and I have some questions about that. But we'll talk more about that later. The other 2 areas I'd like to add to this list are city-owned vehicles, and licensed child care homes. Other provisions they talk about are requiring no smoking signs be posted. Instead, I'd really like to see some kind of a sign that says in a more positive manner, Morro Bay is a smoke-free city. For people who find a need to smoke, we kind of discussed a couple of possibilities, perhaps in the back area of a couple of our parking lots in town, or, as some cities have put in their regulations, designated smoking areas with cigarette butt receptacles in an area when others are not expected to be present. And I can think of several examples of this. So that is what I would like to see, and now I will listen.
Thank you. I'm certainly supportive of moving forward with some of these actions to enhance our smoking guidelines, and agree that on page 3, most of those, with the exception of potentially the outdoor working areas, you know, 1 through 6, I would agree with, and support looking at increasing some restrictions in those areas that we do not currently have restrictions. I think that designated smoking areas would provide an option to serve where some areas might be eliminated, and therefore not denying that right for those who are wanting to smoke. And at this point, yeah, I'm not really looking at some of the other things in regards to I kind of like the idea that it's a menu of choices, and don't know that I want to go as far at this point in housing regulations and more permit fees and things like that for businesses. I'm looking more at just some of these things in regards to smoking areas.
Noah. Yeah, thank you. I'm going to agree with both Carla and Nancy with what they've laid out here. I am actually interested in talking a little more about the tobacco sales concept. I'd like to give our chief of police a chance to discuss that. I think if we were to pursue it, it would be important that it was fully self-funding. I wouldn't want to do something that put a burden on our general fund to try to maintain. But from the testimony and from reviews I've seen of what happens when you aren't able to maintain a compliance check operation such as what this licensing would fund, that we end up with the situations like we do where we don't have very good compliance in our community as far as sales to minors and so on. I think the cost that it looked like range that was there was relatively affordable for the improvements we'd see in reduction of sales to minors, which is a very serious issue.
Are you talking about, can I interrupt a second? Are you talking about the licensing
of yes.
tobacco retailers? I'm going to submit that the item is discussion and consideration of regulating public smoking, and an ordinance on licensing tobacco shops would be a different discussion. And I'm also going to submit that everything that's been kind of presented to us is a lot of stuff, and you're throwing a whole other thing in the mix. I know it's been brought up by the public, but I'll ask the city attorney. He's talking about licensing tobacco dealers, and the item is consideration of regulation of public smoking.
It is part of my staff report. The licensing is another element of it. So, and it certainly will be coming back for public hearing. Not only a public hearing, but it'd be the first draft would also come back as a public hearing. So we'll have two before that time. So I mean, if there is a majority of council that actually wants to venture into that issue, I'd like to hear about it tonight, so at least we know if we're going to head that way.
You know, and I'm willing to get overruled here. This is a time matter with me. That when you talk about popping over the police chief, we're going to get sidetracked here for 30 minutes just on licensing issue. when we've just been presented with these seven things. So let me, Council, is what you want to hear? I'm good with it if that's what you want to do.
I wouldn't mind a brief take on it, because my understanding was we get funding through ATF already, or one of those organizations for it, tobacco regulations.
I don't have the nexus here between regulating public smoking and licensing of tobacco dealers, other than they both have to do with tobacco. But
which is,
I've made my objection. You take it back.
Okay. Chief, if you would.
I will do my best. I believe the question you're asking is if we pursue as a city to have a retail license for people that sell tobacco, that is set up to be, in a sense, cost recovery is not typically 100%, but they try and make it as close as possible for enforcement aspects of that. I can tell you that the county has passed a similar ordinance, which then other cities tend to follow suit, which means Morro Bay does not. So we're surrounded by an ordinance that tends to push the youth towards our area for tobacco sales. So I know they have done studies in the past and have seen that on the average there has been an increased sale of tobacco. They have done a couple operations where they went around to several of the establishments and for youth under 18 to purchase tobacco, and the percentage was high for Morro Bay. So there is that problem in Morro Bay. I believe that if you have any other questions, I'll try and answer them.
My other question, thanks for that, is it's a little bit off topic, but it was raised, and I think it's a good point, is currently what is the fine or the process for littering of cigarette butts?
I couldn't tell you what the fine is off the top of my head. It would be just a standard littering citation that they would be cited into the Muni code.
And that includes a financial penalty, or is it community service?
It would include a financial penalty.
With community service?
I don't believe so. It's just financial. If we do an administrative site, the first site would be $100. I don't know if there's a reduced fine for that for littering.
Mm-hmm. And if we wanted to pursue a community service component, is that possible?
Through our administrative site process, that would be something we'd consult with the city attorney, but I'm sure there is something we could work out there.
Okay. My other question for staff is, we've got a lot going on. How much time would you anticipate going into this, if you can break it down into the licensing concept as well as this the smoke-free ordinance concept?
Are you talking time in putting a new ordinance in place?
Development and a rollout, yes.
I don't know if I could give you an hour amount. I know the Tobacco Coalition, this is a focus for them for this year and the next year, so I'm sure they would provide support. There's already an ordinance out there, as I said, that is in effect in the county, so it'd pretty much be adopting a similar ordinance that's already in effect in our county.
And the same for the licensing concept as well for sale?
That is what I was referring to. Okay. It would be the licensing concept.
All right. Then with the education component, which has been mentioned in the staff report, the EBYC and Tobacco Control have both offered to participate. Would you see them as viable supporters or even implementers of an education component if this is the direction we want to go?
I wouldn't want to speak for them directly, but I think from their support here tonight, I think you could see that it is something that is high on their list for support.
And would that be helpful to our staff as we develop this, if we do?
Absolutely. Any type of educational outreach is our first approach to try and get compliance.
Okay. Thanks. Those are my questions.
Boy. What a topic to bring up at almost 10 o'clock at night. I think we're probably We're dealing with a real slippery slope here, I tell you that. You brought up San Luis Obispo. Anytime you want to go into San Luis Obispo and walk down to one of those pubs or something, there's people out smoking. Who's controlling this thing? I mean, you pass ordinance that you can't not enforce. And this, unless you got a police department of 100 police. I was in the bar business when smoking was allowed in the bars. And I thought it was a kind of slap people's rights that they weren't allowed to smoke. But I kind of, I learned to live with that and understand it. And but there comes a time when, since this is a legal thing to do, you know, and there's a lot of places on this, I really think that smoking should be stopped, definitely. But again, how are we going to enforce these things? I mean, why have these things if we can't enforce them? They can't enforce them in San Luis Obispo. It's a joke. You know, those poly kids, they smoke. And I'm sure that, you know, there's even, what do you do about this? I mean, maybe I can ask you, how would you enforce this?
Thank you. Yes, I think for enforcement purposes, it's very similar to when we started the ordinances related to the beaches and the piers. The primary focus is what we call passive enforcement. You're correct. We don't have the enforcement staff to go around and monitor this on a daily basis wherever it is. But I think through a passive type enforcement, which is kind of a peer pressure type thing, educational aspect is a huge component of this. We worked with Estero Bay Youth Coalition. They were proponents of the smoke-free beaches. They made their own posters. We had a contest. The posters, the winners were chosen. They were posted all over town. So education is a huge aspect of passive type of enforcement. This would be similar. It would be complaint-driven. We wouldn't be going around. We wouldn't have extra police that would be designated just to go work this a smoking ordinance. So it would be passive, peer pressure, complaint-driven type enforcement.
And another thing, you know, the way the economy is going, a lot of people come to this town. I don't know, probably let's take a number like 20% of the people that come smoke. And we have quite a bit of foreign people come here. They seem like they all smoke, you know. How are we going to deter these people from coming in? Or do the business people look at this and say, you know, we're going to start to lose business because of this? I think this is a really a tough thing. I really think that smoking should be prohibited in a lot of places. You say 25 feet from a playground. I think it should be more than that. I mean, that's ridiculous, 25 feet. I mean, this is a big subject here. And I mean, just to have a little meeting here close at 10 o'clock at night over this is we need to take a better look at this. And then, but we've got to be very careful with this. And like I said, putting up putting in the ordinances that you can't enforce, because I see people still smoking. I don't know. I see still smoking on the pier. You know, what am I supposed to do? Run out there and say, you know, put that cigarette out. You know, you're smoking on the pier. Citizen arrest. Don't you think they're still smoking on the beach? Do you think it's all stopped? It's just, like I say, I don't know. Maybe, like I say, if we have places and areas where people can smoke, then maybe they will go to that. But we got to consider that they have a right to smoke. And I know that, like I say, that these bars, people step outside and smoke. God, I don't know where to go with this. It's just a tough deal. And I like I say, I don't like my grandkids having smoked around them, you know, and in their areas. But I think we need a lot of more discussion on this, that's for sure.
Well, guess where I'm going to come from? You know, I'm the lone smoker up here. 20% of us do smoke, and I'm holding up my end on the council. I think
can I interrupt Bill? Shouldn't have Bill stepped down from this one? Seems like I'm stepping down every meeting.
No humor past 9 o'clock, please. Don't lighten up around here. I'll speak for most smokers. I think there are, you know, inconsiderate smokers. I think most of you who know me well and have been around me a long time, I mean, if somebody objects and people walk up to me and say, yeah, that bothers me, boy, I put it out. If people could come up and they get in my face and they're nasty, I don't. I mean, I'll be honest. That's how I operate. Treat me like a human, I'll treat you like a human back. I think a lot of, we all know smoking's bad. Nobody will argue that point. I do take exception to a lot of what we heard tonight is about annoyance. You know, there's a guy down on the waterfront, and I don't like to pass him because he smells so bad. And I'm not trying to make fun of him or be funny, but he's very offensive to me. But I don't want to outlaw BO. I mean, I'm not going to go there. We got an email from somebody who claims that chimney smoke is 40 times more carcinogenic than cigarettes. And what are we going to do about chimney smoke? That's next. Barbecues. We got a barbecue down there in Morro Bay Boulevard. We all know that barbecue smoke is carcinogenic. You know, we walk by it, we smell it. You know, if it offends you, don't get near it. What are you going to do about the drinkers at Fuel Dock? We all see them, both corners. I'm one of them. When my son plays there, I go to Happy Jacks too. Sorry. Fuel Dock. And stand in the corner with the kids with the bucket there and have my cigarette. And you know, the last thing, what are you going to do with those people? Say, you can't smoke here, but 2 blocks down on the left, there's a smoking area. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And smokers, we're addicts. We're going to go have our smoke. We're going to, you know, force us to get into our car and sit in our car. You would, I know. I don't disagree with playgrounds and parks and there's certainly inappropriate places to smoke. I've come to terms with not smoking in restaurants and bars. But there are a couple places in town where we can sit outside and smoke. Thank God for those, but this will be done away with. I'll be honest with you, in San Luis Obispo, I ignore the law. When I'm passing somebody, I put it down. If I see a cop come, I put it down. But, you know, at Cahog, I step right outside of the courthouse and have a cigarette during the break. I know. Don't tell the cops over there, will you? And I'm not the only one. And I'm really not the only one in the streets either. We all see each other. We all know it. So, you know, enforcement's a problem. And I don't, you know, what about the bars? You know, and what about smokers having some place? I mean, you've basically, what you're talking about is let's outlaw it everywhere. And, you know? So, I can go along with some of this, but I can't go along with the sidewalks. The sidewalks is where it goes too far for me. And I would never light up in the bus stop. I just wouldn't do it. You know, or in the ATM line. I don't think you need. I mean, there are smokers that are so crass that they would do it, but I mean, I bet you don't see it very often. I don't. So that's where I'm at. So it's back to you, Nancy. What do you want to do with this?
Well, thank you for your comments. I did listen. Most of it I wouldn't argue with, but there are a few things. I see a lot of it on the sidewalks. I think that's one of our major issues is not only the litter, but the smoke that floats into businesses. And as I said, you and I obviously talk to different people in this town. I mean, we've been through this before. But a lot of business owners with whom I speak are offended by people standing outside their stores and the smoke blows into the store. If you want later, I can give you a list. I would love to go all the way with this to the apartments and the licensing for the tobacco sales, based on what I heard tonight, but I'm not sure that we need to go all that far right now. I think we need to start, and I'd like us to see us start with the recommendations I made. Just a couple of rebuttal items. If you look at page 6 of 7, it talks about the right to smoke. A question of whether or not to ban this would be an infringement of a person's right to smoke may be raised. However, smoking is not a protected right under federal or state constitution, and it's being banned in more and more places all the time. It's not as if we were going out on a limb and doing something very different. I know George said a couple of things about foreign people who smoke. I was talking to some folks in the tourist industry, and they found that less and less smoking, there are less and less people from foreign countries who are smoking. As I told you earlier when we started, the whole country of Ireland does not allow smoking anymore. They're a little bigger than the city. I think Chief Olivas did an excellent job of talking about how we would enforce this with education and peer pressure. And in San Luis, also, it's complaint-driven. I mean, they don't have cigarette police who go around and watch. George mentioned college students smoking. The colleges, California State Universities, have now banned smoking on college campuses. So, I mean, that's another place it's happening. So while I can certainly understand what people were saying tonight and the need to look at other things such as the tobacco licensing and the apartment buildings, I just don't feel like we can go that far right now. I think it's a step-by-step approach, and I'd like to see us get it off the sidewalk. I've talked with a couple of bar owners in town, and they were not diametrically opposed to this. They said they have patio areas where smokers can go. There are ways to work it out. And we have this part that I would like to put in about smoking where others are not expected to be present, whether this is in the back of a parking lot or 2 o'clock in the morning someplace. I think we can talk about places like that. But I really feel like we need to move forward with this and have it come back as a public hearing item, not at 10 o'clock at night, as George mentioned, or almost 10. And that's my opinion.
I can tell you right now, there's a bar, I won't say the name to get them in trouble, but there's a bar in San Luis Obispo. They smoke in there, right in the bar.
Don't tell a name.
Nope, don't tell a name.
I'm sure they do.
And they don't even nobody even goes down there and checks them out. It's amazing.
But see, that's
we always use San Luis Obispo. We're saying how well it works there. Well is it working there?
Actually, George, I did a lot of research on this and found that there were several cities. Carlsbad is one of my favorites. Carpinteria is another one. Small beach cities that have already done this. And so I did a lot of research other than San Luis Obispo. I've been reading.
Yeah, I would like some clarification on Ireland. When you say there is no more smoking in Ireland, what do you mean? Are you saying they don't smoke on the sidewalks in Ireland?
Right.
Do they sell cigarettes in Ireland?
That I don't know. I'll find out for you, though.
Well, I would bet a buck right now, and I'm a big gambler, that they sell cigarettes in Ireland.
Okay. I'll take you up on that one.
You want to bet me?
Sure.
You think they don't sell cigarettes?
No, I'm sure. Well, no, I probably better not bet you because they probably do. But the question is, where do you smoke them? In the privacy of your own home or in your car, as you said earlier.
Can I?
Well, I said before, I agree with a lot of this stuff about where people should not smoke. There's definitely, don't get me wrong, but there's how do we define these areas? How, like Bill says, you can't smoke outside of a bar, but you can smoke three blocks down. Or do you got to get in your car, drive home, have a cigarette, and come back? I mean, at GAFCO, I got a lot of smokers there. I guess they're going to have to drive. Go, like you say, sit in your car and smoke. Is that all right? How are you going to do this?
I'm sorry I let this get out of hand a little. Carla?
I have a question for the city attorney in regards to how we look at this, if it seems like we'll be moving forward on some of this as a menu to come back, public comment, first reading, all those things. How difficult is it then to come back time-wise and process-wise to add other elements to it as we, you know, a year from now, 6 months from now, well, I wouldn't think 6 months from now, or we'd do it all now, but, you know, can we add to it or do we have to redo it then?
No, you can certainly add to it or subtract from it if it's not working. At any time, you could do a first reading again and adopt an amendment to the ordinance.
I have a comment.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd suggest with the licensing that we include that now. I think you're going to see strong participation from the Tobacco Control Coalition and the Youth Coalition. And by avoiding that now, we're creating a scenario where we may not see as much participation from their side. And it makes sense to do this all as a unit so that it's we can communicate the new regulations in one clean effort instead of breaking it up and creating perhaps more legwork for our staff and so on. I assume that putting it together, if we want to go there, is more appropriate. And I think the licensing part is important because of that sales to minors point that's been made multiple times tonight and how we lag behind the rest of the county on that.
I would like to respond to that, if I may.
Go for it, and then
Thanks.
It's my turn.
Well, I might give it to George. You know, Tobacco Control Board, is that what they're called? I mean, they come into town, they use our police, and they go out and they make busts, and it sucks, I think. And some people on the staff know how I feel about it, because they don't warn. But I'm cool with people getting ticketed, fined, you know, when they've been warned. You know, I don't know why we need this. The percentage-wise is, if you know, San Luis Obispo is down to 3%, and we're at 17%. Well, San Luis Obispo has like 180 licensed tobaccoers, and we've got 18 or something like that. So, of course, we just have one, bam, we've got a higher percentage than them. That's not a fair comparison, respectfully, to both of you. So just wanted to make those points.
Well, my point would be that anyone who's selling tobacco has already been warned by just having the ability to sell tobacco. It's by law you cannot sell to a minor, and that's a pretty clear warning to me that behavior as a business is not acceptable. So I think you've already got your warning just by deciding to sell tobacco in itself, just as you do with alcohol.
Well, you know, then we have a different view on enforcement and community-friendly enforcement. You know, I know the case of a kid at Albertson's, and staff knows about it because I've let him know about it. He was working. He was a checker. This happened last year. Tobacco control, our police. This is the way it was described to me. So they bring in the 40-year-old looking 17-year-old who's in the crowd and buys a pack of cigarettes and goes and blam. So this kid, 20 years old or something, he's a checker there, he got fined $500. And got suspended for 3 days, and Albertsons got in trouble. You know, Albertsons and the employees, they don't want to sell tobacco to kids. They don't want to, believe me. You know, there's no, you know, we have another one in town. They're north of 41, and, you know, they kind of continually do this. I have different feelings about them. But to just come in and do this, and that's what I'm hearing from you. Well, you just get them, boy. And I, you know, it's like, lighten up. That's my feeling.
Well, I would say that entrapment is not appropriate. And there's a line that you would want to make sure isn't crossed. I think that our police department would be able to walk that line more easily with a licensing process and with participation, deeper participation. Brought up a good point. It's a question that I have that we haven't talked about yet is, and I need some clarification on it, is from what I understand currently, if an employee mistakenly or purposefully makes a sale, that they're held accountable. If I could ask the chief of police to comment on that.
I'd be happy to. Thanks for bringing it up. That is a key component of the retail license. Currently, the person that makes the sale is the only one that's held responsible.
Owner of the store who's responsible. And with that in mind, I would support your suggestion that we move this forward on that in addition to what we've already talked about. I think also the fact that the Tobacco Coalition is certainly willing to step in and help us with working this out and work with us on this issue, that's important to me, that we would have the support. And I really think if we're going to do this, we need to support them also. So I would agree with Noah.
Can I ask a question? I just for a clarification, I guess. I'm not under the impression that that the salesperson is relieved of their fine just because the business would be responsible.
Thank
I believe
for asking.
They still would be also, correct?
Yes. The person that makes the transaction is the one that is doing the illegal activity, but it also gives an avenue to hold the owner responsibility. I don't know what the fine bases are, if they are the same or if the owner's held to a higher standard. We would have to research it more to find out what the actual requirements are.
So it makes it doesn't take that away. It makes it worse.
No, it doesn't make it worse. I think it makes it better. I know you and I are going to disagree on a lot of this, but I think it makes it better in that it makes the owner more responsible. What I would like to do at this point is move this forward with the suggestions we've made and have it come back in a month at the end of March, if possible, as a public hearing item. Yes, sir, you're going to say something.
I believe I have direction as to the protections for the outdoor public space. I just didn't know if there was a majority, and maybe we'll wait for them. Does that motion also include a licensing requirement also, or are we just moving forward?
I haven't heard a motion yet at all.
Okay.
Do we make a motion on just a discussion item, or do we ask to move it forward?
If you want to move it forward, it's got to be my motion.
Well,
okay.
Before you get to that point, I would just want to say that I would be supportive, seeing that we potentially are going to be somewhat divided here. You know, I'm supportive of moving forward in a lot of this, especially in the outdoor places. But I would, and I appreciate that it came in a menu option. I'm not, and I don't know, Rob, if we can separate it out then once it comes, if it's an all or nothing, because I'm not really supportive of number 7, and I'm on the fence with number 6 still with the sidewalks. But I would be supportive of all the others, and I don't want to lose something along the way if it's an all or nothing.
No, it absolutely is not an all or nothing. And my suggestion, since the motion that I would be looking for is to bring forth an ordinance that would regulate smoking in public places, include 1 through 7, and then you can have at the first hearing, which would be the draft, you can decide whether you like that language or don't like that language, and you could take out any of them or change that language. So that would give you the option of seeing the language in your ordinance for 1 through 7. And so that would be part of the motion. And then the other part of the motion, though, that I'm not certain of is this issue of whether we should be licensing the tobacco. And that really is a separate ordinance. That would fall under our business license and is separate from the ordinance that these items will go in. These items would be incorporated into our current ordinance that regulate the smoking in the beach. And at the piers, it would be within that, whereas our licensing the tobacco industry retail sales would fall under our Chapter 5.
And I would be reluctantly willing to consider that as long as the intent would be that we would keep it at that minimal amount and not that maximum amount of licensing fee, because I think that's just detrimental to businesses right now.
Yeah, I'm getting so confused. I don't even know how I'd want to vote. What are we going to vote on?
What number numbers are we talking about? You know, I can get behind 1 in 5. Here, the smoker could get behind 1, except for number 1, the word bars. You know, number 2 is already, that's already law. Public events, you know, Harbor Festival allowed smoking, but I think music, no, they didn't. Okay. Music Festival didn't.
Yeah. Did they smoke at Harbor Festival?
Yeah, I think they,
yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm. I think they did last
sure
year.
They do. I got guys smoking.
Well, in front of your bar.
Yeah.
yeah, what are you going to do then? You know, it's his bar in there, you know, I mean, that's going to be a problem. Service areas, I already told you, I don't smoke in those kind of places.
So if
sidewalks
it comes back,
is my problem.
If it comes back as a menu at public hearing, then we can go through and vet it.
Right. That's my understanding.
You want to leave sidewalks and work sites in?
I'd like to leave all of these in, even at this point, work sites, although I'm not fond of it. But I did want to add city-owned vehicles and licensed child care homes to this list. And drive-up windows to number 5.
I'm supportive of the drive. I'm willing to have it.
Drive-up windows are part of number 5.
But you said 1 through 9.
Yeah, 8 is city-owned vehicles, and 9 is licensed child care homes.
Go ahead.
1 through 9.
I got it now, ma'am.
Thank you. And we bring that forward for a public hearing. And that's my motion.
Second for comment. Is the regulations then going to be a separate one, Rob, or is it encompassed in the same motion?
I would take that as a separate motion after this one.
Well, then would I? Yeah, that would be a separate motion. So when we come to new agenda items, we could no?
We could do it just as a separate motion after this
okay,
one.
Okay, so we could do it now after we vote for this one. So we'll have 2 votes. Is that right, Mr. Mayor?
That's the way it's looking.
Thank you, sir.
Any more discussion?
Yeah, I'm still confused.
Okay.
It's coming back.
It's that water you drink.
I can see taxi cabs with wings on it. Getting burned out. Do you have any discussion, Noah? Any discussion?
Noah, let's be real clear on these motions.
She's bringing it back. Basically, we're bringing what back? She's added 2 things for a public hearing.
Yep, protection of outdoor public places, 9 areas. And to number 5, I have added.
Care isn't an outdoor place.
It is not, no.
Well, I can't go for sidewalks.
Well, guess what? When we do a public hearing, you can voice your opinion.
The 80% of people don't smoke, stand up. 20% of smokers.
I understand 50% of the French smoke. It is gross. You know, I'm not a proud smoker. You know, I'm an addict, and you know, I don't like it. I hate being tied to it. But you know, that's 20%.
It is what it is. And my intent was not to embarrass you.
And
I apologize. Good. I'm glad you're not.
He's very hard.
How'd you embarrass me?
Well, I mean, having to admit that you're addicted and all.
I admit that every day.
This is turning into an episode of My Family.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Okay.
No.
3-2.
Okay.
I think I'll have a little. You think it's water in there, don't you? This flask is not fooling anybody.
It's Listerine.
Okay. I would move that we also move forward with a regulation concept for tobacco sales as discussed.
Second.
Discussion. And I'll just make a statement that I'm not going to vote for this because I'm not in favor of more laws. Let's just make it tighter and tighter and, you know.
I'm not voting for it either.
Well, that makes at least 2 of us. Maybe we'll have a 3rd one here. What do you think, Noah?
No.
All
We're
in favor,
not
say
voting
aye.
Aye.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Motion carries 3-2.
Wasn't a vote, George. We're bringing it back.
Now, can I ask 1 follow-up question?
You may, Noah.
You're not going to like this.
Why?
But the item is concluded.
No, it's
no more motion.
I'm interested to talk a little bit about what the process would be for that community service element for littering of cigarette butts specifically. What's involved with that?
We want money and community service.
How about that? I'm more interested in the community service than the money, but
how about that cat of nine tails?
We'll
I got
bring
it
that
on
back when we bring that to the ordinance.
Okay.
Yeah, we can discuss that and see what the outreach and what other cities have done. And
do you need a motion?
No. Okay. It'll be part of our when it comes back to you.
Okay, you don't have mattresses done on those jail cells, right? They're hard. Okay, we don't want comfort down there for the cigarette butt flickers. I'm going to...
Well, I guess we're all going to have to go to Cayucas and...
It's not allowed there either.
Are you guys okay to hear this?
You better get Pismo Beach. You better get everybody.
D3, yeah, I'd have enough. D3, Rob.
Yes, this is another discussion and consideration of amendments to the taxi cab ordinance that you currently have on. It was requested by council to bring this back in order to try to streamline and remove impediments to the taxi cab companies in Morro Bay. I do have a brief history on taxi cabs and actually did some interesting research on the history of taxi cabs regulations, but I won't bore you at the hour. Basically, I'm looking for direction in this ordinance on whether you want us to go through the streamlining process. I've taken our current taxi cab ordinance and actually outlined in yellow the areas that could certainly be rewritten to streamline the process. Just looking forward, if you want me to move forward with streamlining this and taking out many items, I would work with obviously with our police chief on which items he feels still need to be necessary. I would note that this ordinance is ordinance number 5. It was passed in 1964 and hasn't been rewritten since then. All the way up to, you know, items of the current regulations require that the taxi be available 24 hours, you know, 7 days a week, which certainly seems to be a little onerous for a taxi cab to meet those requirements in Morro Bay. It talks about all the way down to just the taxi cabs needing to be clean and orderly at all times and subject to inspections. So, and the police chief might elaborate a little bit on even currently, although our ordinance requires us to go through inspections of the cabs, we rely on the county's inspection as opposed to our own. I believe that's the way we currently are doing that, which certainly would help us in streamlining that to at least coincide with what we're doing, with what our ordinances say. And with that, I'll turn it back to you for input and where you want to go with it.
Okay, I brought this item forward in the spirit of A, streamlining our municipal code, but also from 15 years ago, a man trying to start a cab company here, and I remember him here so many times, and just all we did was put him through a meat grinder, and in the end, he didn't do it. I think it was because of the insurance requirements were just too much. And then about 10 years ago, I was approached by a man, and he wanted to operate a taxi here, a retired guy, which has always been my fantasy. You know, hey, some retired guy wants to do this. They will never go through our ordinance. And so I explained the ordinance to him, and he said, screw it. And, you know, he operated here for a couple of years. You probably all remember him. He used to pick up at Happy Jack's. He only worked at night. He didn't work 24 hours a day. He never caused any harm to anybody. And he kept drunks off our streets. So we all know we have Paul, the surf cab. I don't want to get his name wrong. He's operating in town, and he's doing a great job, and he's licensed in San Luis Obispo. So and I think they must have similar rules as we do because of just from his number. I mean, within our code, you have to have the phone number and the name of the thing, and it's got to be in the back and the front and the sides and the top, and it's got to be 4 inches here and 6 inches here. And personally, I don't care if a cab has any markings at all. If you know, I'm out to you in the South Pacific where they don't have licensing of any kind. The cars, everybody's a cab, and when they want to be a cab, they take their magnet taxi sign and they put it in the roof and they drive around, and then when they've stop being a cab, they take the thing off and it looks like a car. That works for me, says Taxi. Keep the licensing simple. Have the chief and the city attorney come back with what they feel are the minimums. Background check was brought up today when I was talking about Rob, and I said, why do you need a background check? And okay, you know, I can see some reason for that. I mean, many cab drivers in cities where I come from, they did background check on those guys. They wouldn't have any cab drivers. So I just want to see this simplified, and that's my goal here, and that if another retired guy comes along one day and wants to operate a taxi here locally, he can do it by just going and getting a business license, filling out a form. Chief does his little background check, boom, make sure he's got insurance, and it's a done deal. That's my goal. Who wants to go first? All right.
Well, I think this is interesting. I agree that the taxi operations are helpful in the community and for more reasons than just helping people get home from the bar and that shouldn't be driving, but also for elderly and those without automobiles. I'm intrigued by this Danville code, although I think that there's an important concern that we need to make sure we address, which is clear license and markings, because there is that public safety element. You don't want to create a situation where there's a challenge with an average member of the public knowing who has undergone this background safety review, so that if they're waving a cab over, they can trust that that is a cab driver that has gone through that process, and that therefore it's a safe environment for them to get into the back of that vehicle. So I think that's a really important component. I wouldn't want to see that removed. I wouldn't mind talking about a hybrid of the Danville option, but at this point it looks to be
deregulate and make it easy for somebody who wants to do it. That's my, I think. Go ahead and respond, then we'll get the rest.
Great. Well, my response is that I'm certainly willing to look at this Danville ordinance. It's much more simple, and so I'm willing to go there, but I'm not willing to say, for the sake of making it easier for a cab company to open up, that we're going to reduce the public protections for their safety. I think that's important, and you know, to say, well, I trust that because we're a small town, we're not going to see predatory action out of a cab. I don't want to go there. I've been aware of too many situations where, yes, a small community has become a place where someone that you wouldn't want to be operating is operating, and it may be a very short term. I just got concerned when you said you want the licensing and the markings to be as simple as possible, if any at all, is what I heard. You could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think those markings, that licensing, that clear licensing is a chief component to operating a professional cab, so that there's an avenue for a person that's either not happy with that service to address that concern, or that there's a way for them to just identify very quickly that this is a cab service that was looked at by the police department and they've done the background check.
Okay. George?
All I want to know, can you smoke in this cab?
No.
It's not on the list.
It wasn't on the list.
No taxi cabs on the list.
Anyway, Bill, I don't understand about the marking on a cab. It seems like a cab would want a marking on it, but I can't get hung up on that, and it seems like to me that would be up to maybe the police could handle that or something if they wanted to have markings on cabs to separate them from cars. Are you really hung up on that?
No, I didn't mean to infer no licensing. I never said that, and I didn't mean to infer no marking, because you've got to identify yourself as a taxi. What I don't like is in our ordinance, I think it goes on for more than a page, it lists out doors, back, top, and sizes, and you end up looking like the cab that we have, because he goes by San Luis things. you know, if you want to operate a cab and you want to do that, that's fine. I don't want to legislate it. I'm good with taxi. That works for me. The South Pacific concept, that works for me. You put a taxi sign with a light in it on your roof, and I'll bet you within 30 minutes the police department knows about it. That fast. That's how small we are here. There was another point I was trying to make. Oh, Danville. Danville is, if you're licensed somewhere else, you're okay to operate here, which is basically what we have going right now with Paul. He's licensed in San Luis. He's not even licensed here, I don't believe. But they have such... Is he? Okay, he is. But not for their, with our taxi ordinance? Really? Well, it's because he went through it over there. So the Danville thing is somebody goes through the San Luis thing or Pismo, and, you know, nobody's on a bandwagon to make them lighten up. Then they're good. And then I would like to add, if you don't want to be licensed there, that it's easy here. They can't pick up anywhere else outside of our city limits, but they can at least deliver to the airport if that's what they want. But they can't operate anywhere outside of Morro Bay. So that's, to me, it's a streamlining thing, and it's to allow somebody who wants to do it to be able to do it. That's my goal. Nancy.
Did you just say they
can't go to the airport? They can go. But they can't pick up there.
They can't?
I suppose, if I don't know how that would work. If it's a Morro Bay resident and they did a reservation, but even that, I think it might be illegal. Problem?
Currently, if you have a license in the city of San Luis Obispo, you've got it in the county, and you pick up the passenger there, you can bring them to Morro Bay, but then you're supposed to drop them off, and if you do not have a license in Morro Bay, you're not allowed to. And the same would go for the other way. If you have a passenger you're picking up at Morro Bay and taking to the county airport and you don't have a county license, you're not allowed to pick up a passenger. You have to come back to Morro Bay before your next passenger.
Let's take it
enough.
A little further. If suppose it's you and you live in Morro Bay and you call Joe Blow, our little local taxi guy, to pick you up at the airport.
No. You could not unless you had a county airport license.
Okay. Thank you.
How difficult is it to get one of those? Excuse me.
George, I'm going to shoot you.
To get a county?
I mean, every ordinance is different. I'm assuming the county is probably a lot like ours, where you have to go through that public hearing and necessity.
So I agree with you. Isn't it surprising?
Thank you. And I won't
okay.
argue
with you. And I think we ought to add rickshaws. Bicycles.
Carla.
Certainly echo the sentiments of making sure that we're providing a safe safe ride for any passenger in our community. I just real quick, because I think we'd beat this to death otherwise, from the city attorney, how is this ordinance, other than it needs to obviously be updated because it's from the 60s, is it similar in kind to the other ordinances around in this county and the other cities? I mean, are we an exception with something
no.
stricter, or is
no.
this a standard?
It's pretty close to the standard, but you have seen in the past 10 years where many cities are undertaking to try to update them and deregulate the taxi cabs. Like I said, I could go into the history of, you know, the taxi cabs regulations, but the mayor's saying to spare me. But, I mean, they came forward based, you know, in the 20s and 30s and needed to be heavy regulated in the big, big cities, Chicago, New York, because of the crime and the, even the mafia involvement in them. And so, it has an interesting history, and you know, cities just adopted that from the 60s. We looked at it, and it was just adopted. You know, the question is it preventing a taxi cab company coming to Morro Bay? I don't think so, but we wouldn't know that until we actually changed it and made it less restrictive to see. You know, a lot of it has to do with the economics and just not having the base to provide for it. But it certainly, you know, we could certainly deregulate. And one of the, you know, just taking out the public hearing process, we don't require that for other business licenses. And it seems like if they come forward and we can provide the background check, they can be administratively handled, and that alleviates a lot of concerns. And some of the other just onerous. When you read it and it talks about, you know, the 24/7, the requirements that you have to go through, the color schemes, you know, you almost have to provide architectural renderings of what your cab's going to look like.
those are the things that we can look at and streamline and bring back to you. I mean, I think that's the where council wants to go. This was just to bring forward to see if that's where you actually want to go. If everybody's in agreement, we'll do that. And we understand that the primary also is to make certain that the public is protected. And I could provide you a story personal on that in San Francisco, but I'll wait for another time for that one.
So in a sense, administratively, it would come back similar to what we've done with the arcades. So it's still going to have law enforcement oversight, all the things updating the ordinance, but remove, because we see how many people come for arcades for public hearings.
Yeah.
None. So it would be, and I would doubt they would for taxis either. So, yeah, I could certainly be supportive of that.
And, you know, in two cases that I could think of 20 years, we have basically said no because of our regulations. One of them in the 90s, it was insurance. I do recall that it was the insurance. He couldn't do the premium. It was just too much. But we were forcing it on him, $2 million or something at the time. And the other one was the story I told you about 10 years ago, and he just did what smokers are probably going to do after you steamroll this thing in, is they're just gonna, you know, he just ignored it. He just operated, and the cops knew, and nobody, we had public comment today. So
one last comment,
please. If you promise it's the last one,
I think so.
Just one.
I can't promise it, but
one.
I don't see anything, because it seems like we're going more in the direction of this Danville code. I don't see anything in there that speaks to revocability. Would that be included?
Although I would head towards the Danville, there are still things in the Danville that we need to make certain, like you said, the revocability and requirements and providing that, because that's necessary due process-wise. But, you know, if you want us to streamline it, that was our question, then we'll come back with a draft ordinance and you can pick it apart for those issues. You know, why didn't you put revocation in here? Why did you keep this in there? And let you pick apart at it.
So we come back with a draft. It's not a public hearing. We chew on it one more time, and then, okay, so I'll make a motion that we direct the city attorney to bring us amendments to Morro Bay Municipal Code Chapter 5.24 regarding taxi cabs, with the goal of streamlining and simplifying the regulations.
Second.
Discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries 5-0. Declaration of future agenda items. Carla.
Yes, please. At our last meeting, you had on there residential development impact fees, and I'd like to see if I could get some council support to bring that item back with a different spin on it that would give council a menu of options. I was opposed to the total elimination, but not but was amenable to some changes, and I'd like to include some enhanced elements for the green building things, so not to devalue that. I'll do the work to bring it back, if that's okay, if I can get some council support, and I won't use staff time.
I know, but you made one.